Welcome, everyone, to the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Today is April 6th, second hearing of the day, 5 p.m., and we're going to start with a public hearing on House Bill 3373. Open a public hearing. Representative Reardon. Oh, yes. Cassie, could you please read the summary?
House Bill 3373 appropriates money from the General Fund to Housing and Community Services Department and Department of Land Conservation and Development to each employ one full-time equivalent employee to perform services relating to increasing availability of affordable housing. The bill declares an emergency effective on passage.
Okay. Good evening, Chair Kindergar, members of the House Human Services and Housing Committee. First of all, For the record, I am Jeff Reardon, Representative District 48, which includes Southeast Portland, Happy Valley, and Clackamas. And before you start, I want to thank you for being here this evening. Obviously, housing is such a huge issue. It certainly is in my district. And I appreciate that you are working late this evening to try to help. So, anyway, thank you for giving us the opportunity to speak to you this evening. I'm here to show my support for House Bill 3373. In 2014, Representative Parrish and I chaired the Affordability Balanced Choice Work Group, and we had a mission to provide recommendations to increase affordable housing availability for the 2015 session. Well, now it's 2017, and we're still going strong. House Bill 3373 was one of many ideas that came from the work group. Many of the fundamental issues with increasing the supply of affordable housing, even if funding is available, have to do with planning and availability of land. Here's a quick summary of the situation we're trying to address. State land use law, Goal 10, requires cities to include space in their plans for affordable housing. Other presenters can explain in greater detail some of the challenges with reaching compliance. I'll only say that cities want to comply, but they often lack the technical expertise and need more advice and support. As it currently stands, many cities fail to comply with Goal 10. The Housing and Community Services Department is Oregon's housing finance agency that provides funding and programs to support and preserve and discover affordable housing for Oregonians of lower and moderate incomes. So once again, we need to help reaching from one silo in our state systems to another. This bill would facilitate planning that addresses the state's Goal 10 requirements and includes the housing experts in the process. Having both staff at both Housing and Community Services Department and at the Department of Land Conservation Development would allow us to address more opportunities to increase affordable housing options. We need to increase capacity, build better tools, and encourage housing development to meet community goals. House Bill 3373 would help us achieve this. Thank you very much.
Perfect timing.
Chair Kindergar, members of the committee, for the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37, Westland and Tualatin. I will just say, ditto what you said. I don't even know what you said, but it's probably
good. It was good, though.
Okay. Did you say how wonderful I was? All right. So Representative Reardon and I seem to be sort of a Mutt and Jeff on housing. We had the opportunity to serve, as you know, on the ABC task force. Would happily do that again because I think housing issues are really important. And I know that this is a little bit of a lift in a session with tight budgets, but ultimately, as one of the concepts, you know, the housing, affordable housing is very complex. There are issues of land use, finance, some of the backyard issues that happen that need to be negotiated through. And so it would be very unusual for me to be on a bill that asks for new FTE. But in this case, I do think it is important that we make sure that we are helping at the local level as much as possible with builders and building those bridges with the folks who want to be doing affordable housing, figuring out what the roadblocks are, and then, you know, reporting back to this body with that staff where we need to make policy changes in order to make affordable housing work. So that's my quickly brief testimony, and we'll just keep bringing you bills, Madam Chair.
Great. Fantastic.
I'm hopeful that this is FTE that helps spend our other money much better, more efficiently and effectively. So
yep.
Thank you for having us here this evening.
Really great. Well, you've got a lot of supporters here, so we're going to call them up quickly. We're going to try to be as efficient as possible today, since we've got a lot of bills and we're going to be getting hungry soon. John Chandler, Mary Kyle McCurdy, Aaron Doyle, and Allison McIntosh. I think all four of you want to be together. Talk about Mutt and Jeff.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. Apparently, I missed a meeting of our cabal and was nominated to be the spokesperson. We're here in support of HB 3373, and there's written testimony that was submitted. Ms. McIntosh from the Housing Alliance prepared it. But I just want to call your attention not only to that, but to the fact that all four of these groups sitting here in front of you, the Home Builders, the Housing Alliance, 1,000 Friends of Oregon, and the League of Oregon Cities, we oftentimes, as you've heard in this committee and other places, don't see eye to eye on a whole bunch of issues. On this one, we are absolutely on the same page. This issue is critical. Getting these positions placed in these agencies and funded is critical to getting a hand start down fixing the housing problems. And a little bit of history, if you'll indulge me. The DLCD, Department of Land Conservation and Development, used to have housing staff. When we first started doing comprehensive plans years and years ago, we read them. They had Goal 10 expertise. They made sure the housing inventories were done. They made sure the local governments were following the rules. And then over the years, that expertise simply retired, was not replaced, eroded, other priorities came in. And now the DLCD doesn't have that, even though they're charged with enforcing Goal 10 and helping local governments comply. OHCS, or Oregon Housing Community Services, has never really played in that policy agreement arena all that much. They should, and they want to. This allows them some staffing help to make that happen. We believe this bill is critical. Like I said, it helps restore that expertise that used to be there and was very valuable, has been lost. This starts restoring it so that local governments can access state policymakers, get some technical expertise to help them on their planning and writing of ordinances and whatnot at the local level. This will help ensure that state housing policy, of which there's a fair amount on the books already, is actually followed, enforced, and results in better outcomes on the ground. We collectively recommend this bill to you.
Well, that's a great way to keep it quick. Any questions from the committee?
That's not like him, though, to be that quick.
I gave him strict marching orders before. Yeah. So one of the bills that we had passed that had a split vote on this committee was the bill to require small cities under 25,000, if they wanted to go through a planning process to expand their UGB, had to go through a certain set of requirements. And one of the concerns was it would be hard to do that without technical assistance or support. And this is one of the ways that that can happen. So the position in both Housing and Community Services and Department of Land Conservation and Development will work together to really help cities. And so I think that's one of the really critical pieces to it and addresses one of the concerns that was raised by this committee. So, wow, okay. Do you want to each introduce yourself for the record just so we know who else is here on for Allison, audio?
Sure. Allison McIntosh, Oregon Housing Alliance.
Mary Kyle McCurdy, 1,000 Friends of Oregon.
Aaron Doyle, League of Oregon Cities.
Fantastic. Okay, and we've got one more person, Peggy Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. You have our testimony on OLIS, so I really just want to focus on a couple of things. We have already testified in support of this concept at the DLCD budget hearing. And this is what we said. We also share our disappointment that the governor's budget did not include a shared staffer between DLCD and Community Services Department, Housing and Community Services. Providing housing for everyone, especially for low-income populations, including low-income workforce housing, is a top-level conversation in this building. But the answers differ around the state. Having a staffer with an eye on both land use planning and making it happen side would be very helpful for all Oregon communities. Again, often a staffer can help multiple communities, thereby stretching our limited state dollars. I would be more than happy to support two staffers if you all will find us the revenue. But in the meantime, I am stretching it because this money isn't even in the governor's budget. So I really think it is, you have heard from them, they have said the right things. We need to accomplish this, but we also need the revenue to make it happen. Okay. So thank you.
And as a reminder to the committee, we are here to examine what is important policy. When we pass something on to Ways and Means, that's going to be their struggle down there. So with that, thank you very much, Peggy. May I have a motion, please?
Are we in a work session?
Oh, thank you. Close the public hearing on 3373. Open a work session on 3373.
So, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3373 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Olson moves House Bill 3373 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion on this bill?
Yes. Madam Chair, I'd just like to point out this is one of the few opportunities that the Republicans are enjoying the majority in a committee. So just wanted to relish that for a second.
That's true. Okay, let's see how efficient we can be with that.
Keep the damage to a minimum.
Exactly. All right. No further discussion here. Okay, Ashley, please call the roll.
Representative Gorsuch?
Excused.
Representative Meek?
Excused.
Representative Nierman?
Aye.
Representative Noble?
Excused.
Representative Peluso?
Excused.
Representative Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sanchez?
Aye.
Chair Kenny Guy?
Aye. Motion passes. Okay, close the work session on House Bill 3373. Open a work session on public hearing, on 3405. Take this over for a second.
We have.
I'm outnumbered again.
Well, just feel free to write in and get started.
Okay, great. Hello, committee. I'm Alyssa Kenny-Geyer, state rep for House District 46, parts of Southeast and Northeast Portland. I'm here again symbolically to show my support. Representative Hayden has really championed this with support from Representative Parrish and the past Representative Tobias Reed, I believe John Davis, and others to try to find a really innovative way to make sure that we get our tax credits out to low-income communities for child care and child independent care. Tax credits out in a monthly manner, and Representative Hayden has really been the champion, so I'm going to let him explain it, but I'm up here symbolically to show my strong support for this because I've been working with him on this for the last 3 years.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Olson, and Vice Chair Sanchez. When you have the chair sit beside you on a bill, that's got to be a good thing. So this bill goes back to 2015 when I sat on the Human Services and Housing Committee, and we were talking much about tax credits and the function.
Sorry to interrupt, but old vice chair.
And my name is Cedric Hayden, state representative for House District 7 from Douglas and Lane County. Thank you. So back in 2015, we were discussing many tax credits and the efficiency of those tax credits and which ones would go forward and which ones would sunset. In that discussion, we brought up, if we're going to talk about the efficiency of tax credits, particularly child care tax credits, in House Bill 3541 back in 2015, there was an attempt on a strong bipartisan attempt to get those child care tax credits to the recipients on a monthly basis rather than an annual basis. From a cash flow perspective, if you are given a one lump sum of cash that is designed to pay for your child care for the next 12 months, you can assume that that cash may not be available in month 3, 4, 5 through 12. And so we wanted to design something that would allow people to get their earned tax credit or refundable tax credit in the month that they had the child care that they needed to pay for it. Seems like a pretty simple concept. We ran into many discussions about whether or not if you get a monthly payment from a state government, whether that is countable towards your SNAP or your food benefit and possibly your TANF. Mostly the concern was around SNAP benefits, whether that was countable, and would we in fact be forcing folks off the rolls by getting them a cash flow that they could spend monthly. LFO looked at that. There was a determination by LFO that was ambiguous, but Lori Freeman felt that it wouldn't. There was concern that it would, so we wrote to the USDA, and they gave us a determination that the ruling on it is a gray area, and they felt that although it could be accountable, that the state had the right to exempt that if they wished to, and that we could move forward with that. Over the summer of 2000, we tried again in 2016, kind of the same result. Over the summer of 2016, we continued to work with the USDA, and most recently, I wanted to determine whether the new administration would support what the prior administration said, that the state had that discretion. We did get a letter back, in full disclosure, that the new administration in the USDA felt that it could be countable and may require us to have a waiver from them to make sure that it wouldn't be countable. And so, not being defeated, but being sidelined a little bit, I have reduced and narrowed this bill with much support, that we will ask the Department of Human Services to get a waiver request from the USDA to determine for sure whether or not the SNAP benefit would be, or the monthly benefit would be countable, so that we don't push people off the rolls. One of the things that I'm concerned with in our human services is one of the proposals that we have before us to decrease people off of these benefits is to count Social Security benefits that we haven't ever counted before in the state. And so rather than that proposal, I would propose, if we are going to be reducing, taking a risk of reducing benefits is better than guaranteeing reducing benefits, and a avenue to get it to them monthly rather than yearly. So thank you very much for your time, and hopefully we can take a small step forward on this.
Thank you. I'm not sure who's chairing this at this point, but both of you, rock, paper, scissors. For the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37, Westland and Tualatin. Loved this bill. I loved it in 2015 when we worked on it. And a little bit of the technical side of this, there's already precedent at USDA to front load dollars, and it comes out of the school lunch program, and that's where sort of some of this idea came from. So when you sell school lunch in the month that it's sold, you're really front loading like commodity dollars into the next school year. So the number of lunches that you sell in school year, 15-16 will pre-fund the school year 16-17 to 17-18. There we go. But it front loads the next school year, basically. And then there's a reconciliation piece that happens. And so in the original bill, what we decided was that we would give a portion of that tax credit loaded onto a SNAP card, because you can debit dollars, cash dollars, off of an Oregon Trail card. And then save a portion of what we think we owed based on last year's tax returns, which we're about to file again. And so in this case, if this bill were in effect right now, 2016 taxes that people are going to file would front load the next 12 months. So based on what they earned, they would take, say, 80 or 90%. And we'd save a little portion at the end to reconcile that tax return. So maybe they made a little more or they made a little less. But it would give people dollars in the month they need them, and when the expense is incurred. And so otherwise, it's almost like taking on debt for the individual taxpayer who's earned these credits. And so if you think about somebody who doesn't have good cash flow, they're working poor, they're putting money on credit cards. They are, get your billions back, America, right? Those are the H&R Block ads. They're doing when the tax refund comes, they're doing a loan on their tax return at a very high interest to get that money back, because they're so desperate to pay off bills or try to, maybe get a car out of hock or something that is, some big expense that's incurred. And so not only by putting cash into people's pockets, pocket in the month that they need it, are you helping them pay the immediate expenses? You're also deferring things like a lot of interest charges and loan, you know, payday type loans that they would be incurring all year waiting for that tax return. And so, you know, we started with daycare credits, but we also at some point want to, if this works and we get the waiver, we want to also look at things like earned income tax credits, any of the refundable tax credits. You know, there's a bill that we've worked on, and Diego Hernandez is interested in working on a rent tax credit for low-income renters that would be refundable. You could put that on this type of card and actually get people their money back in the month that they need it, and not waiting till April 15th or waiting until H&R Block or somebody, not to pick on them, but loans them the money to get their tax return back. And so to me, as somebody who's been really poor, cash flow is a big piece of getting out of poverty, having the money and being able to make those expenses without having to incur debt. So really quick, hope you guys move this and have my commitment, certainly to go to our federal administration, they wear our jerseys right now, and to go out and put pressure on the Trump administration to take our waivers from our state and let us be innovative and try things. And I think that making sure that we have that relationship with the federal government and those of us who can go and speak their language can say, look, this is really important to the state of Oregon, and we need you to move us this direction. And the precedent already exists in USDA for doing that front loading of payment systems.
I just want to add one thing, and that's that this was Representative Stark, I know Representative Bueller's in the room, this was a big topic for the Human Services and Housing Committee 2 years ago when we were looking at all the tax credits. And so the idea with the child independent care, which was used to be child independent care, and the working family child care tax credit got merged into one, and that's when Representative Hayden started saying, why is it that people have to wait January, February, they earn the money for that tax credit in January, February, March, April, May, June, July, all the way through December, and then they don't get that back until April, anywhere from 3 to 15 months after they've actually earned it, when the purpose of the child care tax credit, just like the ERDC child care payments, is to help people pay the very high cost of child care. So that's where it comes from. But I do want to remind you that this bill does not set up the program. It does not mandate that the program is set up. It's a very, very simple step of asking DHS to request the waiver, because we don't want to go through the trouble of starting a program without being really sure that the monthly income distributions are not counted as income that would make them ineligible for SNAP or TANF benefits. So it's very simple. There is no mandate to start this program. All we want to do is be very clear about that one question before we take any possible steps further. So that's what the bill is. Very simple, small step, way smaller step than we tried to do a couple years ago. So any questions for us?
Any questions? Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Belit Burke and Philip Kennedy Wong, if you'd come up.
Madam Chair and Chair Olson, members of the committee, for the record, Philip Kennedy Wong. I will be very brief in my remarks. I'm here to represent Oregon Food Bank. I want to begin by thanking Rep. Hayden for continuing to champion this concept. We support exploring this conversation as whether or not we can make an improvement in the lives of women who are trying to work but yet are facing the challenge of child care, and want to share with you just a quick experience that I had just yesterday. We had a bunch of mothers who were in a TANF program who came from various organizations and various backgrounds, met with state legislators, and I had the privilege of hosting them for several of these meetings. And the you know, one of the biggest themes that I heard was the dilemma of childcare versus a job. And sometimes, well, actually a lot of times, these jobs don't provide sufficient resources to be able to pay for child care, much less cover their basic necessities. And just to give you a sense of how much money we're talking about as far as discounting, as far as a SNAP benefit, it's my understanding that the average monthly benefit in SNAP for a household is roughly $123, which is not a lot of money, but it could be enough to sort of disqualify someone from you know, this tax benefit. And you contrast that to, with my recent experience, I would say in the last 6 or 7 years when I had my two young daughters in daycare in Portland, we were paying upwards of $900 a month just in child care costs. So we appreciate the opportunity to share with you our opinion, and we hope that this committee will move this bill forward. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Representative Kinnegar, Vice Chair Olson, and Vice Chair Sanchez. My name is Belit, for the record, my name is Belit Burke. I am the Self-Sufficiency Design Administrator for the Department of Human Services. This bill directs the Department of Human Services Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program to write a waiver to disregard the state child care tax credit as recurring income for the purpose of determining eligibility. We believe the intent of this bill is to help families meet their needs and have safe child care while they're at work. We would be happy to work with Senator Hayden and any of his staff while writing up this waiver if he chooses us to, and so we will do that for you.
Okay, great. Any other questions? Okay, I am going to close the hearing on House Bill 30405. It's not totally clear which direction it needs to go, if it needs a referral, so we're going to hold off on a work session. And I am going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2377. Oh, I'm sorry, House Bill 3387. Cassie, could you read the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3387 establishes a task force on system development charges to review existing law and policy relating to system development charges imposed by local governments in Oregon. The bill specifies task force membership and staff support from the Legislative Policy and Research Office and outlines provisions for the task force to consider regarding system development charges. The bill directs state agencies to assist the task force, and the bill is effective the 91st day following sine die and is repealed December 31st, 2018. We do have a -1 amendment, and the -1 amendment adds a member who is a public or private sector professional and adds an additional task force member representing the League of Oregon Cities.
Thank you, Chair Kinnegar, esteemed Vice Chair, committee members. For the record, my name is Newt Buehler. I represent House District 54, which is most of the city of Bend. And I think Cassandra did most of my work on this. It's a short bill. It's straightforward. And it's simply forming a task force to study system development charges, or better known as SDCs. I don't have to explain to this committee the difficulties we have with affordable housing in the state of Oregon. It's a complex issue. There's lots of causes that you have all heard now over the last 6 weeks. I've thought deeply about this, as I know Representative Kenny Geyer has, and there's lots of causes. One that I underestimated when I first started looking into this topic is our lack of investment in infrastructure and how we're funding it. It's complex, and it hasn't really been studied or looked at in any in-depth fashion for decades now. And what we see as the system development charges become more and more expensive, sometimes ranging $30,000 to $50,000 per housing unit, that it's very difficult to develop a house when your system development charges are that high, that's affordable for someone with workforce income levels. So it's high time that we roll up our sleeves and start looking into at least this aspect of what's contributing to this affordable housing crisis. So that's it in a nutshell. I'd be glad to take any questions.
There's two more people about to speak, but does anyone have any questions for Rep. Buehler? Okay.
Thank you very much
for bringing this to us. John Chandler and Aaron Doyle.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Again, for the record, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here in support of House Bill 3387. This is a bill that we asked to be brought forward, and I'll briefly explain why. There's two main reasons. The first one is that it's been almost 30 years since we adopted our system development charge law, SDC law. That was 1989. The only person left around the game that remembers what the original deal was and all the negotiations that went into it is me. And if I'm your institutional memory, you probably have a problem from the start. But more substantively than that is a lot of things have changed in that 30 years. For example, We passed a law in 1989, as I mentioned. In 1990, the voters passed ballot measure 5, which completely turned over Oregon's property tax system upside down and implicitly took one of the major underpinnings of the logic behind our SDC law off the table. Then subsequently, again, we passed ballot measure 50, which even made that situation worse. And it's been 14 years since we've looked at this law in any kind of substantive fashion at all. And even then, we didn't go back to the basics of why are we doing this, how are we doing it, what's the best way to pay for things. And the second big reason was during the interim a couple years ago, a gentleman who probably should remain nameless, since he didn't know I was going to tell this story, but a retired public works guy, and I did a presentation for one of the special district associations and found out a room full of very well-intentioned municipal engineers and city infrastructure types that they were doing the law wrong. What they were doing, we simply have not tended our field and made sure that people know how to work the system the way it's supposed to work. And I'm not unhappy about that at all. It simply meant to me that it's probably time to do a revisit. And there really, honestly, truly is not a hidden agenda, ulterior motive, or anything else. This is a critical piece of municipal infrastructure. We have a property tax system that is fairly well fixed, unfortunately, although I commend any bills to you that might unfix it at some point. And it's probably time to look at how we pay for this stuff. Because at the time we started, local governments did have more property tax authority than they do. We didn't have stormwater fees to any great degree because at that point it was a couple hundred bucks a house, perhaps. Now, because of EPA, DEQ, and stormwater environmental regulations, all of which are appropriate, those fees are now in the many thousands of dollars and probably going to go up from here. Affordability, we simply didn't think about affordability all that much back in 1989. We didn't think these fees were going to be all that much money. If early days when I was negotiating these with local governments, it would have been in the $2,000-$3,000 range. Now, as Representative Buehler mentioned, they're upwards of $30,000, $50,000 in some places. And I'm not quarreling with those numbers at all. It's simply a lot of money to pay if we're doing it on a per-door basis and trying to do affordability. It's something that we need to look at. And finally, and this is, I think, one of the more critical pieces, when we passed the law, we were, I think, the first, if not one of the first, nationally, state to do a comprehensive look at impact fees. In the intervening 28 years, all sorts of other models are out there. I know my national group, the National Association of Home Builders, has done extensive work on coming up with ways of how to do pay for infrastructure, various methods around the country. I would imagine the National League of Cities and the National Association of Counties would have done so as well. When we did this in 89, we were out in front. Now we can take a fresh look at it, see if we can borrow some ideas from other places that might work better that we simply didn't think about or haven't implemented or don't fit within our current law. I think it'll be a dreadful, awful task force, to be honest with you. But I think it's necessary. There's nothing inherently sexy or fun about system development charges, believe me. We did ask for some legislative participation, so you've been warned. Some of you may get volunteered. But it is a critical bill. We do hope to move it forward, and we hope it'll pass. Okay. I'd be glad to take questions.
Thank you. Chair Kennegeyer, members of the committee, good evening. Erin Doyle here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. SDCs, they're complicated. They're difficult. We do at the League an all-day training for our members so that they can get a handle on how to do the methodology. And to me, that speaks to the level of complication that system development charges present for us as well. And I'd be very happy to have more creative ideas for funding infrastructure. Over the past interim, the League of Oregon Cities went out and did a pretty comprehensive survey of our membership to find out what the infrastructure cost needs are sitting at right now. And the numbers have multiple digits and a billion attached to them, but I can't remember what they are off the top of my head. Somewhere around 11, I believe, considering transportation, water, and sewer as our main systems of infrastructure. I do think this task force will be complicated. It'll be difficult, and that's part of the reason why I pursued the Dash 1 to add some clarity to the cities that have to be represented, one large, one small, because I think the impacts of changing SDCs and looking at the methodologies will have different impacts on cities of different capabilities. And then in talking with Mr. Chandler and myself, realized that perhaps neither one of us should consider ourselves experts on city finance, and thus the city finance, municipal finance expert. Additions, I really appreciate Representative Buehler being so flexible and understanding, and Representative Clem as well, and Mr. Chandler allowing us to do that amendment so quickly and get it turned around. At the end of the day,
if we can find new and creative ways to invest in our infrastructure, I think that's going to be critical, because not only do we have a capacity building cost that comes when we build new houses or even new development of any type, but we also have a maintenance cost that we have to continue, and we can't use the SDCs to pay for that, and I'm sure that probably will be outside the scope of the horribleness that will be this task force. But infrastructure funding is a piece that often gets overlooked when we're talking about all of the different reasons why many different types of land isn't developing the way we want. So I look forward to taking on the task of helping my city members participate as vocal and concerned members of this task force. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
And just for clarification, John, you're fine with the amendment?
Yes, ma'am. Yes. Madam Chair, members, I meant to do that. Yes, we are completely fine with the dash ones.
Okay. Any questions?
Yes. I'll just make a little comment. So thanks for your testimony, both of you, but you're both wrong. I don't think this is all that horrible of a thing. And if the speaker's watching, I'll volunteer to be on the task force. So.
Okay. What punishment?
Okay. I don't know what happened. It must be too late.
Yes. We should have an intervention, Madam Chair.
Okay, that's great. All right. Can I have a
close?
Oh, thank you. Close the public hearing on 3387. Open a work session on 3387.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the dash one amendments into House Bill 3387.
Vice Chair Olson moves to adopt the dash one amendments dated April 6, 2017. Is there any discussion?
Not on the amendments.
Okay. Any objection to the amendments? All right. Amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3387 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Okay. Vice Chair Olson moves House Bill 3387 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion?
Yes. Madam Chair, I'm disappointed. Yes on the bill, absolutely. I'm disappointed that it's going to Ways and Means. If you read through the fiscal on this, there's a potential for zero cost if it's scheduled during ledge days and session. The only cost listed is for the legislative members who would have to travel to be part of this. And in fact, we have one who lives right up the road volunteering. So it just seems like so small. And I'm just really surprised that it's going to Ways and Means. It seems like we could.
For clarification, every bill that's a task force, we've been asked to do Ways and Means. Every other bill we've passed so far out of this committee is going to Ways and Means, even when there's minimal fiscal or indeterminate fiscal. I think they like to see in Ways and Means, you know, how many task forces we're loading up on the different departments. And so they just want to make sure if all of a sudden all the different departments are asking, you know, all the different committees are all throwing something toward Oregon Health Authority or something. They like to be able to weigh that. So often it's not a fiscal decision, but looking at division of resources in a different way, personnel and others. So every single bill we've been asked to do that, simply for that reason. Okay, so any other discussion on the bill itself? All right, Ashley, please call the roll.
Representative Gorsuch?
Excused.
Representative Meese?
Excused.
Representative Nearman?
Aye.
Representative Noble?
Excused.
Representative Peluso?
Excused.
Representative Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sanchez?
Aye.
Chair Kenninger?
Aye. Motion passes. And we're going to close the work session on House Bill 3387, open a public hearing on House Bill 2377. Representative Brock-Smith, you're here. Will Cassie please read a summary of the bill?
House Bill 2377 allows cities and counties to create a property tax exemption for rehabilitated or newly constructed multi-unit rental housing within their boundaries, depending on the number of units made available to low-income households. The bill provides a framework for cities and counties to grant property tax exemptions and takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment on sunny day.
Okay.
Madam Chair, committee, thank you so much for having this hearing. as we all know, there's a housing problem in Oregon. And thank you. I always forget this part. State Representative David Brock-Smith, House District 1, representing Curry, Coos, Douglas, and Josephine counties. We all know there's a housing problem in Oregon, and one of the solutions to that housing problem is supply. And that's what this bill does, is it allows tools and a vehicle to incentivize supply. There's two main parts to this bill. The first part to this bill allows a builder of multifamily housing to negotiate with the jurisdiction of local government to abate the value of reassessed, of assessed value of the taxes involved after the building is constructed. But the carrot, if you will, is that they must put a portion of the rents to the average median income within the county. And so that is something that can be negotiated between the builder and the unit of local government prior to either the refurbish or the building of the multi-unit housing. And it's something that they can negotiate down to the penny, really. It allows a lot of leeway to local government. It's, of course, a program that they can enter rather than forced to enter. And really, it allows an ability to have that unit of local government who knows what their housing shortage is, who understands what their tax structure is, who understands what their needs are, to negotiate with the builder of the multifamily housing to provide the units possible. The second part is for new construction of single-family homes, because we don't want to just allow folks affordable places to rent, but we would like to get them into homes that they can afford to buy. And by utilizing the average median income within the county, this is really more of a affordable workforce housing. So the second piece allows a builder of a single-family home to sell to a qualified buyer whose income is within AMI. They would then and their sideboards within the bill, and they would then receive a tax credit if they sold it below market value into the qualified sideboards for the single family for the buyer. In essence, that's the nutshell of the bill. And I have Legislative Counsel Dale here, who is very apt to answer any questions with regards to the mechanisms of the tax credit piece. You'll notice the dash two amendments of the bill, and they are needed to move things forward.
Can you explain the dash two? Is the dash two breaking that up into two different pieces, or no?
No. So the dash two amendment, the original function of the before we changed to AMI, was taking a new approach that took the per capita income and the median household income, stretched it over 10 years, divided it, and then put it together to find a new AMI. It was a little complicated for some folks, and so we figured since everyone knows what the average median income is, it's easier to calculate, then we should use that. So, and the dash two amendments also, of course, set a number of sideboards with regards to building costs. We were concerned, of course, that you wanted to be able to incentivize the builder to build a home, but we wanted to make sure that they would stay whole by selling the property for less than what market value was. This is really a bill for our folks that are teachers. In Curry County and in my district, roughly 30% of the housing stock is owned by people that don't live there. And I'm also on the Port Arthur Langlois School Board, and we have a problem with folks coming. Our teachers are retiring, and new teachers are moving to the area to take jobs in our school district, but they can't find places to live that they can afford to do so. Neither can the folks that are on our police departments and work for our county sheriff's departments. So this, looking at the average median income and the qualified price for is 80 to 100% of the area median income for the home, as you can see on page 6 of the dash twos. It really allows the incentive for the builder of the home to lower the price of the sale of the home by receiving the tax credit on the other end.
Okay. Any questions? Would you like to say anything about the mechanism?
One thing I would point out in the dash two, I'm sorry, Alan Dale, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. In section six, Representative Brocksmith also put in a mechanism for making sure that the house, the tax credit is for the builder selling it to a qualified purchaser, that is someone who's income, household income is within the limits, but he didn't want it then just to go back to market rates. And so there's a mechanism for limiting the resale price for 11 years thereafter. So it's whatever the qualified price for that initial transaction from the builder to the first purchaser was, allowing for 3% growth year over year. And there's some enforcement mechanism having to do with not requiring documentation of the qualified price before you can file a title instrument with the county clerk, and giving someone who purchases a house that should have been at the limited rate, that is above that rate, a cause of action in the circuit court to recover the amount of the excess.
Okay, any questions? Okay, this will take a little more thinking, and we don't have the fiscals back. There was a question, because there's two different concepts in here. If it were just the first part, which is permissive to cities and counties to allow them to pass on a property tax abatement or reduction in return for building affordable rentals, that would be a permissive. And might go to revenue or might not.
It has a subsequent.
But the second one, the tax credit, would definitely send it to revenue.
Correct.
Right. I mean, that's the piece that I know sends it to revenue. Without that piece, I'm not sure. So we are waiting for a fiscal, but
I can, if Madam Chair, oh. I can add that we did put a $10 million cap on the annual available credit. This is the whole purpose behind this bill really came from the need for housing. And if you go through the dash two amendments, you'll see that there's a number of stop gaps there to ensure, as Legislative Counsel Dale mentioned, to ensure that there isn't the ability for you, Madam Chair, if I may, to qualify for one of these homes, buy it, and then 2 years later sell it at full market value. Mm-hmm. Vice versa. We put a stopgap for the builder of the home to be made whole. It's really meant to drive the building of affordable workforce housing in the state. And we all know, and all the data shows, that supply is the problem. And both of these together add not only supply in the rental side, but also supply in the home ownership side. I know there's a fiscal, but we've spoken about that, but in order to solve the problem in our state for affordable housing, I think we need to invest in ourselves, and this allows that to be done. We spend about roughly $35 million a year in the RETC that allows folks to go ahead and take advantage of tax credits to replace windows and heating systems and so forth. We're building clean green homes here and making them affordable for our workforce. And it works through all, for every county, because the AMI is tied to each individual county where they're being built. And so the AMI in my district is different than yours, and so it makes it affordable for everyone throughout the state.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We have four people to testify in this.
Thank you.
Stacy Mickelson, John Chandler, Douglas Schmidt, and Sean Jillians. Do you want to all come up at once?
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Stacy Michelson. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties and here today to speak in favor of House Bill 2377. I'll keep my comments fairly brief. I think Rep. Brocksmith did a great job of outlining this issue. For counties and cities, this is really about local control, which is always one of our number one priorities. Having the ability to be nimble within our local communities and address issues as they come up. As we know, housing is an issue all around our state, but our counties are definitely facing that in varied ways. For some, it's a matter of availability. For others, it's a matter of the quality of the housing that's available and a need to promote rehabilitation of existing properties. And so we see this bill as an opportunity that would really give our folks on the ground the ability to be responsive to the housing needs that are specific to their communities. It's not a silver bullet, but it's another tool in the toolbox. And for that reason, AOC has been supportive of 2377 from its draft form on. So, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I'm parsing through the amendment, Madam Chair, which doubled the length of the bill. So trying to get all the pieces of it and see sort of what the changes were. But I think in general terms, we've been supportive of local governments having the tools to incentivize affordable housing rather than necessarily just having mandates in place. And in the 2016 session, when we were talking about whether or not to do voluntary or mandatory inclusionary zoning, we always made the pitch that no one ever tried voluntary. I think this basically is effectively voluntary inclusionary zoning, but it gives a little more framework so that cities and counties know kind of what they're looking for in that particular program. The other thing that I think is important to note in subsection 5 of the first section, a big concern around urban renewal and other tax abatements is that schools get hit by that. This one has a provision that says 51% of the taxing entities have to agree to it if you're going forward. So I think that's sort of a provision that was put in that's responsive to a lot of the criticism that happens with property tax abatements to incent a behavior. On the state tax credit level, that's extraordinarily complicated in the amendment, I'm going to be honest with you. It looks like about 7 pages to try and figure out sort of clawbacks and where you go with that. I think the goal of that is noble, to entice developers to develop affordable housing for sale as well as rentals. We spent a lot of time talking about rental issues this session, not nearly as much about home ownership. And so we are supportive of incentive-based programs that would increase homeownership development, especially in more rural areas of the state. With that, happy to answer any questions or pass it over.
Madam Chair, members, again, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builder Association, here in support. We like this bill. Like Mr. Jillians, I'm just looking at the amendments, trying to figure out exactly how it would work, and I already admitted in the previous panel that I'm not an expert on municipal finance. I was promised there'd be no math this evening at all, and I'm a little disappointed. But we have for years, and this committee has heard me, and like Mr. Jillians mentioned, in the context of inclusionary zoning, but in also other discussions, advocated for voluntary programs, locally based programs, tools to give builders the incentive to actually build affordable units. It would be inappropriate for me to show up with a very creative idea that Representative Brock Smith brought forward and say we didn't like it. The fact that I'm not sure how it works isn't the point. This is extraordinarily creative. I wish I'd have thought of something like this before when I was having those arguments in previous sessions. Might have made him go better. Mm-hmm. I think he's to be commended to bringing it forward, and I hope we can work it up to something that will actually be passed by this body and go out for experimentation at the local level. As I've said in other contexts in this session as well, we need to experiment on as many things. The model on housing availability ought to be all the above, and let's push as many ideas out on this sort of voluntary, incentive-driven, locally-based programs as we can. And some of them may not work, but some of them will. And if they do, they're going to do a great deal of benefit for the state. We commend you to it. But look forward to working on it further.
Thank you.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, my name is Douglas Schmidt. I'm the Polk County Assessor, and I'm testifying on behalf of the Oregon State Association of County Assessors, OSACA. At this point, we're neutral on the bill, but we do have some concerns about its administration and implementation on the ground level side. The first one is we're seeing this more and more in some of the bills that applications come into cities to approve things, but there's a late filing up to December 31st. But typically, assessors are not able to change values on property after December 31st without a order of the local BOPTA board, the courts, the Department of Revenue, or if it's an omitted property or clerical error. So I would ask maybe that somehow we get some clarification on if assessors, if the city gets a late application by December 31st, we don't get it until January or February, saying whether it should be exempt or not. Are we allowed to change the value on that property as a rule correction?
And so, you're referring just to the second part of the bill then?
The first part of the bill.
First part.
That deals with an application coming in for exemption based on the income level of people. Okay, this is the last part of the bill with the tax credits. We're not in that.
Okay.
Don't want to get into that. Another one is there are some bills that have provisions. One of them is ORS 307-512, where an application comes into the city or county based on a rehabilitation credit or exemption application, and it says that it's filed by March 31st, which is in this bill, but then it has to be to the assessor by April 1st. That approved application. So we would just ask that maybe there be that language put in this bill, that when the city gets it on a timely filing, which is March 1st, according to the bill, it has to be to the assessor by April 1st, as in some other statutes. That's ORS 307-512. That's not in my testimony. These are some things that I had found out a little bit later. There is the calculations that needed to be done on the annual income levels have been cleaned up, but there is still concern by assessors that it's the assessors making the determination of the area median income. Well, for one thing, what is the area? Is it the city? Is it the county? Is it a neighborhood? But the fact that assessors are doing a calculation on median income to determine rent qualifications, that should be done by the cities or the county who approves this. They have the same access to that data as we have. We don't have it, so we'd have to find that out. It's a 10-year window. So this would be something, if the cities and counties want to do it, they should be the ones determining whether the rent qualification is adequate, and that includes determining what the area median income is for that property, for those areas. And there's also nothing in the bill that really differentiates rent amounts between a one-bedroom, four-bedroom. That's more of a policy issue, but that might that could be cleared up. There are in most exemption bills, there's what's called a clawback, which means that if they don't qualify and on purpose they don't do something, that you can go back years. This is not as big a deal on this one because it's an annual filing, that there has to be an annual determination, are they renting what they're supposed to be. So it's not as big a deal, but it is an issue that normally on an exemption there is a clawback. The effective date it seems a little aggressive, because not only it's 91 days after Sine Die, the city or county would have to pass a resolution or ordinance, get that approved, and then they would have to get 51% of the district rates to approve. Seems like kind of a short timeline to make it effective for the what tax year was it? That would allow them to be able to qualify without roll corrections was what I was trying to say. Because if they do this, probably what's going to happen is there's going to be roll corrections that may apply to the 17-18 year instead of just moving forward for the tax year 18-19 with this. And I know it kind of doesn't bring some of this on maybe as quickly as some people want, but it just seems like a very short time period to get this done without causing work and roll corrections where we have to go back and correct values.
Okay. A lot of food for thought there. Any other questions?
Yeah. Madam Chair.
Yes.
Just a quick question on the year evaluation. If we were able to amend it just to say that effective immediately, but for the tax year 18-19, would that work so we could start getting some of the things into place to make this work?
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Meek, that would be something we need to talk to maybe legislative council, but a lot of bills are effective, once the legislature's done, but it doesn't have maybe an implementation date or something until a year or two down the road to let everything to be put together so that it could be done correctly. But that is something I would, or somebody would need to check and see if that's a way to do it.
I have a question, Stacey. You might be the best one to ask, but if Representative Brocksmith might also be able to ask this, answer this. Are there any cities or counties that have specifically asked for this, have shown interest in this?
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, to my knowledge, this did not come at the request of a specific city or county. I know that Rep. Brocksmith was talking about this issue before he had made the transition into the legislature. Mm-hmm. So he may have more insight on whether this was a discussion happening at the local level in Curry County.
Okay. I'm seeing a head nodding no over there. Okay, great. Thank you so much. Going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2377 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3155 and invite Representative Brocksmith back up. And Cassie, can you please read the summary?
House Bill 3155 creates a 7-member task force on the use of surplus public lands for housing to study the sale and use of public lands to address housing shortages. The bill permits the task force to consult with experts, hear testimony from affected persons, and collect data, and requires the task force to submit a report by December 31st, 2017. The bill repeals the act on December 31st, 2018, and declares an emergency effective on passage. We do have a dash one. The dash one changes task force membership to include a member from OHCS and a member representing local housing authorities, and changes the staffing from Department of Administrative Services to Association of Oregon Counties. We also have a dash two, which changes task force membership to include a member from OHCS and a member representing local housing authorities.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Committee, David Brocksmith, House State Representative, House District 1, Curry, Coos, Douglas, Josephine. This is another task force bill, as was previously discussed in this committee. But what this task force would do would be look at the public lands around the state, from the state to the city level, and address what needs could be used by those public lands for housing. It's a very simple bill, and we would recommend the dash two amendments. That's pretty much it.
Any questions?
Okay. Yes.
So I don't know if I'm allowed to ask questions on this bill because I'm a co-sponsor of it. So.
That's okay. You can still ask.
It was presumably a little bit of expertise on it. But I notice you have the President of the Senate appoints one member that's a voting member, but the Speaker appoints one that's a non-voting member. Was there some thought behind that?
Or? There was not.
Oh, okay.
So could you, I'm sorry, because I missed a little bit of the difference between one and two and whether you may be more in favor of one than the other?
Well, actually, I'll let Stacey Michelson answer that question.
Okay.
Because I believe that the latest, we were concerned about the fiscal for the task force.
Mm-hmm.
And if DOS had the capacity because of overloading.
Mm-hmm.
And the last word that I got about 10 minutes ago was that DOS doesn't have an overloading. And so.
Okay. All right, great. All right, thank you. So Stacey Michelson and Ariel Nelson.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, again, my name is Stacey Michelson with the Association of Oregon Counties. First, Rep. Nierman, members of the committee, I'll address that question. I was just taking a second look at the bill. No, there was not any intention in having a Senate member with voting authority or and a House member without. If that is the issue, we can hopefully fix that as this process goes forward. I would think that's just a drafting oversight. I'll give it quick. So this bill came about at one of our housing subcommittees for AOC. We had a commissioner who very excitedly came in with an article and said, I just read this really interesting article about, you know, something California's doing around their surplus public lands and housing. And it just so happened that we had members of the Housing Alliance there speaking with us that day, and they were able to say, actually, we did address that conversation through legislation in previous years, but there were some hiccups and obstacles, and we were only able to go so far with that discussion. And so we went to Rep. Rocksmith and asked for a bill so that we would have an opportunity to potentially work on that this session. And where we landed is that it's a little bit of a longer conversation, and a task force would really be the best option. And as we reached out to more and more folks, we heard that there was some interest there. So part of the dash one and two, we realized that in a little bit of an oversight, we had given OHCS a seat to appoint a local housing authority representative, but not actually a departmental seat. So we wanted to fix that. And then as Rep. Rocksmith mentioned, in the dash one, we did put in the option of AOC staffing the task force if we needed to remove any fiscal. My understanding from DAS is that they currently only have one other task force that they have been charged with staffing that has come out of a policy committee thus far this session. So given that that seems workable for them, I would ask to move the dash two and just add the seat for OHCS. And then we would still have that dash one on hand if when we get into the Ways and Means process, they determine that, you know, it's not workable for DAS to do this. And then we could fill in. Happy to answer any other questions about this, but it seemed like a conversation folks were interested in having and, you know, sort of pursuing if there's a little bit more that we could be doing to work on our housing crisis.
Okay. Hi, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. My name is Ariel Nelson. I'm the Government Relations Liaison for Oregon Housing and Community Services. The agency has no position on the bill. However, the focus of the task force really aligns with a lot of the work that Director Salazar has been initiating, including partnering with other state agencies. And it really aligns with, as she shared, we're embarking on the process to develop a long-term state housing plan for the state, looking at not only the need but existing resources and how best to focus those resources to address the need. And so this task force would align with that process.
So I have a question because we passed a bill last year that talked about having surplus lands from departments go to nonprofits or housing authorities. I just want to make sure that this is covering something totally different that's not covered by another task force or a process that's already in place. So from both of you, I would love to hear if this is getting in a niche that's not currently covered.
Sure. Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, my understanding is that this task force would build off of that legislation. We've specifically included a seat for ODOT on the task force, as my understanding was that one of the pieces that the previous legislation couldn't quite address was around Department of Transportation lands. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of the sort of unanswered questions that we had hoped to be able to explore and work on through this task force. And expand that to other questions that other agencies may know of, since it seemed like OHCS
and so,
was...
Yes, for Ariel, for your department as well, there's nothing else like this going on right now?
Not that I'm aware of, no. I mean, we've had conversations, but this would structure that.
Okay. And so one of the questions is that you noticed something, Representative Nierman, where a senator has a voting member and a House member does not. Mm-hmm. So I guess I would look to the sponsors of the bill to see, do you want to work this and pass it on to the next stage, ways and means without
the task force? You said you had it fixed, though, right, in the amendment?
We don't have one drafted yet. I had not realized that that hiccup, but we'd be happy to draft
that. We can either do that and pass it more clean out of this committee, or else let...
It seems like we should do the right thing, huh? Let's do that.
Let's fix that piece. Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you. So we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3155 and try to fix that one small drafting error. And then, yes, that would be great. Okay, thank you so much.
Madam Chair, I would move to suspend the rules to allow Representative Meek to vote on House Bill 3373 and House Bill 3387.
All right, so Vice Chair Olson moves to suspend the rules for the purpose of letting Representative Meek vote on House Bills 3373 and 3387. Are there any objections? No? If not, Ashley, can you please call the roll on his vote?
Aye. Aye.
Is that good enough?
Sure. Right.
Which aye was
thank
for
you
which
for bill? Keeping it moving.
Aye, Chair. Yeah. Thank
okay.
you very much, Representative Olson.
Let me see here. Representative, is Representative Reardon still? I know he's here, but he's on this committee.
So you do.
Okay. So let me see. We're going to hold you off to the end because you have to be here anyway unless you have any other people.
I'm fine.
No one else is here?
People
all right. Right? One. Okay, well, let's try to do that quickly then. Okay, we're going to open House Bill public hearing on House Bill 3304. Cassie, could you please read the summary?
Oh, we are doing it now.
I guess we will, because you've got somebody here to testify.
House Bill 3304 permits a taxpayer who files an Oregon income tax to designate a contribution of all or a portion of the tax refund to the emergency housing account to be used for housing services to low or very low income persons. This applies to tax years beginning January 1st, 2017 and creates an effective date of 91 days after sine die. And we have a subsequent referral to revenue.
It feels lonely up here. But maybe someone will join me. Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, my name is Dwayne Stark, State Representative, House District 4 in Southern Oregon. And this bill is, in my opinion, incredibly simple. It basically says if you are receiving a tax refund from the state of Oregon and you want to give some of that to the emergency housing account, you can. Pretty simple along those lines. So it does clarify that those monies would be used specifically and or solely for housing or services for persons of low and very low income and can't be used for administrative services. I just kind of felt picky that way given the current crisis. And yeah, that's about it.
Okay, great. Ryan Fisher, why don't you come up and join him and then we'll take questions for both of you.
All right.
Hello, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Sanchez, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Fisher, and I'm here on behalf of the Community Action Partnership of Oregon in support of this bill. I'd like to thank the carrier for putting this together. The Emergency Housing Account is a critical fund to prevent and end homelessness. The community action agencies who I represent and who administer this fund depend on it to be able to do the work that they do with folks across the state. And so in the name of brevity, I won't go on about how terrific EHA is, but it's extremely terrific, and I thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Okay. Chair Kinney-Geyer.
Yes.
I may add one clarification. I do want to point out that this is not the same as your charitable check boxes that you have on your tax returns. Those, there's been some challenges with those and boxes coming and going. This is more on the level of, you know, like with your kicker refund, how you can designate that to the state school fund. It's more, it's on a higher priority because it's an agency thing, so it's not likely to go away and have the issues that the charitable check boxes have had. What that actually looks like on each of your individual tax returns, I'm not quite sure because I'm not an accountant.
Chair Kindergarten?
Yes.
Just a question. Why are you discriminating against people that receive a refund? Some folks that may pay may want to donate some money. Is there any opportunity for that on the tax return?
Chair Kindergarten, Representative Meek, typically the thought was, at that moment, people have money and they're being more discretionary with it, or might be more discretionary with giving it, as opposed to at any of us, actually, at any point, can go ahead and cut a check to that, and I encourage you to do that. And so if someone is cutting a check to the state of Oregon and so desires to cut a check, you know, to the emergency housing account, then they can do that at the same time. But I don't foresee the state of Oregon saying we're going to withhold more from you or require your check to be bigger if you check that box.
Thank you very much.
Okay. So, yes.
Madam Chair, thank you. So I was always confused by those little boxes at the end, and so I'm trying to be clear here. So essentially, though, it is not necessarily it's not a charitable gift then, technically speaking, because it wouldn't be something that you could say then moves against your taxes in some kind of way.
Chair Kinney-Geyer, Representative Sanchez, I would have to defer to someone who knows more about taxes to know that for sure.
Okay. I would think so. Anyway. Allison McIntosh, did you join?
Thank you.
Chair Kinney-Geyer, Vice Chair Sanchez, Vice Chair Olson, Allison McIntosh, on behalf of the Housing Alliance. I don't think we can officially say, we haven't asked our members, but I think I can strongly say our strong support for any funds for the emergency housing account. As you all know, and as you've heard from me and Ryan and many of our members, the emergency housing account is one of our most effective, best sources that we have to prevent and end homelessness for families all across the state. And preventing homelessness is really one of the key things that we really need to do in this crisis to help keep families in their homes. So thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Thank you to the carrier for bringing this bill.
I may add one hopefully final thing, Chair Kinney-Geyer. The referral on this is to go to revenue, where somebody smarter than me should be able to tell us whether it is considered a charitable contribution or not.
Okay. That sounds good.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much. Vice Chair Olson. Can I have a motion?
Thank you. Yes.
Yes, Madam Chair. I move House Bill 33.
Thank you. Okay. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3304. Open a work session on House Bill 3304.
Thank you.
Thanks for
I move House Bill 3304 to the floor with the due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the House Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
Vice Chair Olson moves House Bill 3304 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the House Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Any discussion on the bill?
Good bill should pass.
Okay. Seeing none, clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Gorsuch.
Excuse.
Representative Meek.
Aye.
Representative Nierman.
Aye.
Representative Noble.
Excuse.
Representative Peluso.
Excuse.
Representative Stark.
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Sanchez.
Aye.
Chair
Kinney-Geyer. Aye. The motion passes. All right. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3304. We had listed House Bill 2534 here, but we didn't get a clear fiscal on it. So we're going to... You want to do yours? This one? Okay.
Because I got some folks here.
Okay. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2903.
Oh.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Continuation of this morning.
Yes, so, it is. Yes. Yeah, this is continuation from this morning on House Bill 2903. Oh. My name is Andy Olson, State Representative out of the Albany office, out of the Albany district.
We're all getting punchy here at night.
Yes. So, yeah. Okay. I'm not going to take very much time for you, but I do kind of want to get you caught up a little bit why we're moving forward with and what Senator Gelser was talking about earlier this morning about the Dash 3 amendments and how this all came about and why we even are looking at House Bill 2903. Got to go back a little bit in history. Representative Stark's very well familiar with it. During the short session last year, we passed Senate Bill 1515. That was driven and worked on extremely hard by Senator Gelser during the previous 18 months before that time period. And 1515 was designed with the premise of ensuring that children were safe. The bill itself created some direction and protections and accountability and shifted also responsibility toward the Department of Human Services to ensure that, you know, daycare centers especially is what the problem was that we were experiencing for a couple of them up in the metro area. Unfortunately, what happened as a result of some of the repercussions from 1515, I think, that didn't anticipate occurring, not just from the bill itself, but also from some of the rulemaking issues that surfaced, it had some far-reaching impact on your adolescent behavioral centers around the state. And that's why all of a sudden House Bill 2903 surfaced. And I want to share a couple different pieces. I want to share what the Dash 1 amendments were a little bit about. Those were the ones that I worked on really hard with. I appreciated a number of the folks from the Children Alliance, Trillium as well, Department of Human Services. Dr. Richardson and his staff really helped extreme amount with crafting the direction here. But I'm just quickly here, some of the points that give you some idea of where we were going with this. The Dash 1s did this. It struck a critical balance that prioritizes child safety in three different ways, increasing strategies available to DHS to address child safety and accountability, creating prioritization or a triage for the most concerning events, building greater competency for sustaining safe environments and provider organizations. I'll stop right there on that issue. Over on the Senate side, at the same time, Senator Gelser was working with a number of Senate bills, but one of the issues that we needed to some issues to address dealt with what's known as the off-ramp, and that was Senate Bill 246 over on that side. And the idea behind that was that if the director of the Department of Human Services takes action to suspend or revoke a provider's license or certificate, and if they choose to rescind that action, the off-ramp, see, there was no off-ramp at the time through the way 1515 was crafted. They would have to originally agree that Department of Human Services, Oregon Youth Authority, Oregon Health Authority, and also the Attorney General's Office would have to all be in one unison in agreement that that's what could occur. Well, since then, Senator Gelser has removed the Attorney General's Office out of that. I appreciate that from her. But she's also initially started out with a 10-year period for that length as a sunset. She's since moved to 5 years. And then with further discussion, which, again, I appreciate, she moved down to 3 years is what part of the Dash 3 amendments are. Also, part of the Dash 3 amendments reflect a portion of what the Dash 1s did with doing a research project through the Department of Human Services on deemed status for the agencies out there that are providers. Now, I just philosophically want to share this with you from a leadership perspective. I know it's difficult for us as legislators sometimes to consider where we're at on culture. There is a need for the culture to change within the agency itself. You have some very, very good leadership there right now. They get that. But it's difficult for me to sit back from where I have been over the years in leadership to dictate to an organization on suggesting that legislation is going to change the culture. It's through leadership. It's not any different than what you do with the baseball team. If they're in a slump and they're going down and they're well under 500, you look at the manager and change that and get good leadership in there. I'm just saying that generally a culture change takes 5 years, and I think that that's what Senator Gelser recognized when she dropped from 10 to 5, and now she's down to 3. I make that note to you because I appreciate her efforts toward that and where we're going with the Dash 3s. But again, we have some really good leadership in Department of Human Services right now. And if I had my choice, I most definitely would go with the Dash 1s. But because we've worked together and I appreciate that, I'm supportive of the Dash 3s. That's the bottom line.
Any questions for Representative Olson? We have a couple more people to come up on this.
Yes.
I just want to thank you for your work. You and Senator Gelser have worked really, really hard to find some common ways forward on this. And I know the pendulum has been going back and forth for DHS on how prescriptive we should be, and some thought they needed more sideboards because they were being too punitive, and others thought they needed more sideboards because they weren't critical enough. And so I think we're trying to find our way, and sometimes things need to settle a little. I do appreciate that the question of deemed status, which means how do you streamline regulation if you've already got certification under JCO or a national group, you know, should that suffice? It's a really, really big question. And that question is not lost in the Dash 3. That means that there'll be a discussion going forward. I think the other kind of main difference between the Dash 1 that we're not looking to adopt in the Dash 3 is questions of definition of abuse, and many of the providers wanting to have more clarity, more tiered approach. And again, I've heard a real commitment for that conversation to continue going forward to make sure that we get that right. And so it's not in the Dash 3, but I think there's a strong commitment to continuing to have that conversation. So I just really want to thank you for all the work that you've done. Get us this far. Okay, thank you. So we have Doug Riggs and Craig Opperman, or for Craig Opperman.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is not Craig Opperman, but Craig was here this morning, came up from Eugene, and was unable to come back tonight.
Sorry about that.
Wanted me to read his statement and then take any questions that you might have. I represent the entire alliance and have worked very hard on this issue for the last year and a half. So Craig's statement is as follows. Thank you for the opportunity to provide you with testimony on House Bill 2903. I really appreciate the work done by many of you, especially Representative Olson and Senator Prozanski, on this bill addressing child safety in our community. When Looking Glass was forced to close our psychiatric residential service last year, it was primarily due to a lack of adequate funding provided by the contracts with the state of Oregon and CCOs. These payment rates were only covering about 65% of our cost of care. However, the final blow was implementation of Senate Bill 1515, which created a regulatory environment that was impossible to meet financially. Overworked and underpaid staff were spending a significant amount of time answering questions and providing extensive documentation to investigators that took time away from direct care to children and youth. Staff also grew more concerned that a simple mistake could cause punitive response with negative consequences to their career and the future of the services provided. House Bill 2903 was addressing many of these concerns. The current amended bill before you does not change enough to allow my agency, Looking Glass, to consider reopening psychiatric residential services at this time. However, I understand and appreciate that the negotiated amendments that Senator Gelser has provide a small but significant step in the right direction. I support House Bill 2903 with the amendments as presented before this committee today. Thank you for your work on this bill. Sincerely, Craig Opperman, President and CEO of Looking Glass Community Services in Eugene.
Any questions? Yes, Tom.
So, as a service provider on the other, just on the beginning, before some kiddos get to the different programs, I of course have concerns that there's not enough beds. there's not enough places for kiddos who are struggling and who maybe really need the services. You mentioned that the lack of funding caused you to have to close down, or Looking Glass to have to close down. I know that other folks have had to close or turn back contracts as well. Can you give me an idea of what that looks like right now?
Madam Chair, Representative Sanchez, very good question. That is my greatest concern. Just as an aside, I've worked on kids' issues since 2001. I was on the Commission on Children and Families in Washington County. And I would echo a few of the numbers that Janet Ahrens gave you this morning. The first number is 30%, which is the average amount below the cost of care for caring for these kids that we get reimbursed for. The second is 23, and that's the number of programs that have turned back beds or contracts in the last year.
How many?
It's well over almost 400 beds total. And these are, in any given year, those beds might be occupied by upwards of 1,000 kids. So it's a significant impact. And then the last is that number that you referred to, which is 50%. And so we met with the Child Welfare Office and DHS last month, and as of February 10th, they only had about 50% of the necessary capacity available to them. So it's an important distinction. DHS has contracted capacity with providers for more beds than that, but providers are not able or willing to allow those beds to be utilized in this environment. There's too much risk. So about half of the level 4, level 5 kids who need placement at any given time, they have to struggle to find a place to put those kids. And to us, that's safety. These are kids with high ACEs scores, severe childhood trauma, many challenges, but kids are resilient. And they need care and attention and people and places for them to go. And what we have now in the system is a crisis. So.
Follow up. Mm-hmm. Will the provisions or the pieces in this bill help? And to what degree, do we have any idea?
Madam Chair, Representative Sanchez, I think that this bill will be very helpful to entities that have had their license revoked. And at this point, I know of two that have had their license revoked. So if you've had the misfortune to be in a situation where you did something wrong or your staff did something wrong and that led under the regulatory provisions to a decision to revoke the license, then this will give you a path to fix those problems and then apply to have your license reinstated. So for those programs, this is incredibly helpful. And that's why you had Trillium testifying this morning in support of it. They've had their license revoked.
Okay.
For programs that haven't yet had their license revoked, this bill offers potential hope in the future through maybe deemed status, but it does not include many of the other provisions that would have helped the other 26 BRS providers in the state.
And I do understand there's a monthly meeting of the BRS providers, and I think Craig Opperman is on that. So I do, I really want to encourage that continued dialogue. I know there was a big pendulum shifting after the implementation of Senate Bill 1515 and all of the eyes that were on DHS with some very high-profile stories. And they reacted very swiftly to that, and I think have kind of come back. I see Dr. Richardson in the audience, who's has been in charge of that program. It would be great if you'd like to just make a statement or answer a question.
And
so I think there's been a lot of progress and more to go.
If I could comment on that, I agree completely, and all of my members agree. The team that Director Psyche and Dr. Richardson have put together is fabulous. They have worked with my members, and we view that as very positive. We break this into three areas: rates, regulation, and risk. And certainly on the implementation of the regulation, the DHS has been very helpful in the last several months. So that's been a significant, very positive step.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, my name is Dr. Reginald Richardson. I'm the Deputy Director for the Department of Human Services. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about 2903. The department has worked with both Representative Olson and Senator Gelser on this issue. and other community partners, and we look forward to having an off-ramp to be able to continue to work with our community partners when we may have gone into a situation where we've issued a revocation, but they have corrected the issues that led to the revocation, and we have an opportunity to bring them back into the fold, if you will. And so we are very excited about having at least the option to be able to do that. Just want to clarify and correct something. Trillium hasn't had their license revoked. They're in a revocation situation, but we hope with this legislation and some other options, we won't have to do that kind of thing. So I'd be happy to take any questions that the committee might have.
Okay, any questions?
I have lots of questions.
Okay, not too many. Okay. We have a lot of other bills here.
We do have a lot of other bills. Well, I'm just concerned about, obviously, overall capacity. I mean, you know, we're talking 400 beds. We're talking a lot of contracts returned. How can we deal with this? How can we mitigate this situation to make sure that we have beds? You know, I have staff who have referred kids to different places, and there's not options for them. That's an issue. It's a big concern. And it's also, I mean, it's an issue all over. So how do we deal with this?
Madam Chair, Representative Sanchez, thank you for the question. We've not only lost beds, but we've also added beds. So we've added another 65 beds. We've added additional foster care capacity. Is that enough? No, because part of the problem is finding the right bed for the right child. And so we are working to be able to have systems that allow us to do that. We think that when 1515 came online, part of the regulatory situation that Doug began to talk about is because of our implementation, and so the environment that I think that we created really scared our providers away. I think we have made the changes that have been necessary to change that environment, and so I think that we are moving in the right direction. We're not there. Regulatory environment is only one aspect. Rates is another issue. Mm-hmm. And so there isn't a silver bullet or one silver bullet to solve the problem. We have to look at a variety of issues that have led to this problem. It hasn't happened overnight. This has been a longstanding issue. And so I think we will continue to work very hard at identifying what those issues are and then trying to solve them as best we can, given the resources that we currently have.
First of all, thank you very much for your work. I'm not trying to be, you know, picking on the department or anything. I realize that this is a difficult situation. I realize that as Representative Olson mentioned, it's, you know, there is culture to deal with. There is issues, you know, that have been longstanding. I'm just concerned overall that we have service providers who could do the work and are not and are turning back contracts, and we need to figure that one out.
We agree. Thank you.
And I do want to say that I think everyone is in enormous agreement about the rates.
Yes.
And they're at 65 or 70% of what it costs to offer the service, and the amount of time that these mostly nonprofits spend trying to raise money, having gala events and writing grants all over the place when they need to be spending the time on the quality of care for the kids is really a shame. So I hope that that's something that we all can come together with on this in this session. So thank you so much. I'm going to close.
You.
Thank you, Representative Olson, for all your work.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2903. Open a public hearing on. Do you have other people here? Because I'm going to let the people go.
I'm not sure.
Commissioner LeBlanc, go first.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
Okay. I'm going to open a public hearing on House.
I'm sorry, I do for the 3370.
Okay, I'm going to open a House Bill 3370. Public hearing. Representative Sanchez and Cassie, can you please read the...
Yeah. Okay. I don't have my notes on that. Sorry, I don't know where my notes went. Yes, it's okay. It's okay. Actually, there's some other folks who are going to come up and talk with me. Where'd they go?
Okay. Do you want to read the summary?
House Bill 3370 defines housing with services project and requires the project to register with Department of Human Services and meet certain requirements. The bill subjects projects to oversight by the long-term care ombudsman and becomes operative January 1st, 2018. The bill declares an emergency effective on passage.
Madam Chair, And where did our vice chair go?
stalwart, Mike.
Representative Tana Sanchez, House District 43, North and Northeast Portland. I actually submitted this bill on behalf of these guys here. And, you know, I actually didn't get to do a whole lot of work on it because of some timing or scheduling issues, but my staff was able to help out with that. But essentially what the overall concern for me was is that issues of housing that said that we're going to have a certain service, we don't know what that service is, how do we determine, how do we make sure that people are well, what's the right word? Doing it appropriately. I'm going to let these gentlemen go on with it because I feel like they have a better handle on kind of where we ended up because it's different. We have some amendments that will be coming.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. As I know everybody is aware, the Oregon Law Center works on behalf of low-income people, the communities here in Oregon, and I'm very proud to do that work. But to set a little context, I'm going to step back in time to talk a little bit about my previous work as director of Clackamas County Social Services. The reason for doing that, I'm going back to the beginning of time, but I won't go year by year. But basically, when we started long-term care, the changes that happened with emphasizing community-based care, there was essentially no community-based care to begin with. We had to invent it. And then on the housing end of things, I worked on the very first affordable housing tax credit project in the state of Oregon. And over the years, a lot of things have changed. There have been regulations. There have been new levels of care. To bring to closer to the modern times, in 2014, a number of us from AARP, SEIU, and the Oregon Law Center became aware of a project that you have heard about, Madam Chair, and other members that were on the committee at the time, the Cedars-Sinai Project, which is a very complex and good program. We know the people that are involved in it, but it came as a bit of a surprise to some stakeholders about how this program was funded, including getting a federal grant. When we went and took a look at the project, and it's 11 buildings, 4 landlords, and an LLC, we were actually very impressed by the work that the principals had done in creating this project. But it led us to thinking about what is really housing with services mean as we look through all of the different things we've done in long-term care and housing. What is this new model really about, and what kinds of things should we be paying attention to? So in 2015, you all passed House Bill 2547, which created a task force to take a look at this issue. The task force spent a lot of time, and actually the report didn't come out until September of 2016. And there was some agreement, but still in all, there were some things left that really were not settled about the whole discussion. Now, when we approached Representative Sanchez, and I really want to thank you for agreeing to sponsor this, and also, Madam Chair, your interest to see this discussion go forward, we wanted to make sure that we talked to partners and we figured out a way that we could get a little bit closer to what it is that we wanted. So from my perspective, I wanted to see things like a registry for the purposes of the state actually knowing where these entities were, if we had a disaster or other kinds of issues that we needed to deal with. The state really has a need to know and be able to be of assistance. I also would like to see dissemination of information that would happen on things like 211, Aging Disability Resource Connection, abuse hotline, that kind of thing, to be able to provide a standard of best practices. This time around, as we're talking about it, we really are interested to touch lightly on this. And I want to say that in addition to thanking you, Madam Chair, and Representative Sanchez, I also want to call out Housing and Community Services and DHS. They have been working hard on this issue with us, and I think actually have begun working closer together since the task force discussion. So we've made some progress there. And then we talked with all of the major people that you'll be hearing from later on today about how we can get there. And I just want to say that I believe that we're close, and my colleague John Bartholomew from AARP is going to give give a description about where things are. And thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, John. For the record, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, my name is John Bartholomew. I am the Government Relations Director for AARP Oregon. I'd like to thank Representative Sanchez for bringing this forward and all the colleagues we've worked with. You have written testimony from me on this bill, so I'm not going to go through that. You have the task force report. I'm not going to go through that. I want to talk about where we're at now with the amendment process. As we've been speaking to a lot of stakeholders, including the ones that Mr. Mullen mentioned, also Oregon Healthcare Association, Leading Age, and some other folks, we're going to be coming back to you with a very scaled back bill from what you see in front of you. The definition is going to be somewhat changed to remove information and referral as a defining factor and wellness and preventative services as a defining factor of a housing with services program. We were afraid that information referral is way too commonplace and vague a terminology, and wellness and preventive services could mean, a senior yoga class or Tai Chi, exactly, which is very popular these days for improving people's balance, falls prevention. Also, there will be no registration fee, no background check requirements. The ombudsman is not going to be involved in oversight at this time. And public housing entities would not need to register themselves into this registry list, but their info would be automatically shared with DHS. So there's a collaboration being formed between OHCS and DHS so that what Mr. Mullen mentioned would actually happen, that we would know where there are entities that are providing these services. So that's about it. I know the amendment process is moving forward, and hopefully we have those back early next week.
Yeah, that's fantastic. There's other people to testify. Any questions for this panel?
Madam Chair, I mentioned one thing that I want to point your attention to: the testimony of Ashley Coddington Carson, which I think is a really good bit of testimony. She's the Aging People with Disabilities Director. She couldn't be here tonight, but I think she sets the context of some of this discussion and the cooperation that DHS is interested in having.
Fantastic. Great. Thank you so much. Okay, we've got Dan Valliere, Ruth Gullius, and Ariel Nelson.
Good evening, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Sanchez. Members of the committee, thank you for all your work and all your leadership and for letting us testify tonight. I'm Dan Valliere, CEO of Reach Community Development. It's a nonprofit that develops and manages affordable housing in the Portland and Vancouver metro area. We're a member of Oregon Opportunity Network. We've also collaborated closely with Leading Age Oregon through our work on the Housing with Services project that was just mentioned, the one in Portland that started in 2013. Reach was one of the founding members of that. Cedars-Sinai Park, Home Forward, those are the three housing organizations, and then there's also a network of health organizations and social service organizations that are helped establish that. As you just heard, there's good work that's being done to amend the bill, so we're looking forward to seeing that, and as it was just described, is consistent with us how we also view this. It's an important issue. Gathering information is a great thing, and knowing where people are. Our concern really was that the regulatory burden on subsidized housing providers is already great, and it's important that there is regulation of housing, so we aren't against that. But through OHCS and HUD, we already face a burden of regulation that we know how to do, but making it more complex would be something that we'd be concerned about. But fortunately, that was heard, and you just heard that. There's discussion about how to mitigate that, so that was great. And only other thing to add, I think, is that right now this may not be that common. It's a new thing, but it has great promise, and so the idea is to collect information, but also encourage innovation, encourage experiments by groups that are trying to make people's lives better. And we don't require people to take any services. That's an important principle of this work, is that it's choice, right? Residents have choice. It's not tied to their housing. Thank you for your time, and look forward to the next step.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. My name is Ruth Gullius. I head up Leading Age Oregon, and we are a membership, statewide membership association of quality housing and services for the elderly, a variety of members, including federally subsidized housing and market rate housing for seniors. 35% of our membership is as federally subsidized housing. My testimony has been filed for the record. A lot of the issues have already been covered, so I don't want to speak to the concerns that we've had that are being addressed. But I do want to mention some that hasn't been mentioned. We've spoken a lot about the federally subsidized piece of housing that is already heavily regulated, but we haven't talked about market rate housing, some of which is doing an affordable niche, but might not be funded by Oregon Housing, might not be funded by HUD. We would support adding them to the registry, requiring registration under the conditions that what triggers registration is all that they would have to do is apply their name, address, and primary contact, and not place any additional regulations and policies and procedures upon any of these entities in order to really let different models flourish. We really believe housing is a platform for services going into the future with the aging of our population. But we fully support a registry that's going to tell us where these entities are so we can learn more, and that the departments then are knowledgeable about where they are and then can provide valuable information about resources available for tenants. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ariel Nelson. I'm the Government Relations Liaison for Oregon Housing and Community Services. Don't have too much new to add. Just wanted to confirm that the properties subsidized by Oregon Housing and Community Services already are under considerable regulation and oversight, including regular reporting and physical inspections. Some are even subject to multiple layers, depending on how many sources of public funding are there. And so that being said, we already have a quote-unquote registry of those properties, which we've actually already shared with DHS. And so we support the spirit of this bill in cooperating with that agency, and that furthers our work in partnership with other state agencies, and we look forward to working with them to serve this population.
Great. Any questions for this panel? No? Great work, Vice Chair Sanchez. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3370. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3253. You guys have been waiting very patiently. So let's see. We've got we've got James Edwards, Art Stevenson, and Randy Houth up first. And Cassie, could you read a summary of the bill? The bill's going to change somewhat dramatically. But go ahead and read us a quick summary. Okay.
All right. House Bill 3253 clarifies that state agencies and departments shall purchase certain products and services from the Commission for the Blind, and establishes the business enterprise program within the Commission to maintain and manage authorized vending facilities. The bill requires the Commission to facilitate certain dispute resolution meetings and requires the Commission to submit an annual report to the Legislative Assembly. The bill becomes operative January 1st, 2018, and declares an emergency effective on passage. We have both a -2 and a -3. The -2 replaces the bill and defines day-to-day conduct to include the use of a subcontractor by an operator in regular communication with the subcontractor, and includes other circumstances as defined by the Commission for the Blind. The amendment clarifies the definition of a person who is blind and clarifies the definition of vending facility to include state department or political subdivision charged with the care of public buildings. The amendment requires the Commission for the Blind to collect a portion of the net proceeds earned by the vending facility for the responsible operator, and specifies allocation of funds to the Commission and an operator not using a subcontractor, and operators employing an Oregonian with a disability. The amendment also becomes operative January 1st, 2018, and declares an emergency effective on passage. The -3 is basically the same as the -2, but also includes It defined a definition for an operator as an individual who is blind and is personally responsible for 51% of the work of the operation of the operator's vending facilities on and after January 1st, 2023. And it also requires the operator using a subcontractor for the operation of a vending facility to comply with certain benchmarks.
Okay. That was a big mouthful, and I'm hoping whichever one of you starts can just give a really kind of brief explanation about what the Blind Enterprise Services Program is, so people have a, because I think a lot of people here know nothing about it. We've got many new members of our committee here.
I can share that with you.
Go first.
Sure, sure, sure. Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, my name is Randy Hout, for the record, and I am in support of House Bill 3253, and I am a blind Oregon resident, lifelong, been blind since birth. I also serve as the elected chairperson of the Business Enterprise Consumer Committee, which is a public body federally mandated and state authorized to actively participate and represent the licensed blind vendors of Oregon. In that capacity, I'm here today. The Business Enterprise Program is a federal state program. The Randall Shepard Vending Act was created many years ago. Almost every state in the United States, other than, I believe, one, Wyoming, I think it is, has a program. And what that program does is allow blind licensed entrepreneurs, such as myself, to become business persons through the state licensing agency. And in Oregon, it's the Oregon Commission for the Blind. So we go through training and licensing, and then we bid within our rules and regulations. We competitively bid for our locations, and we run them as self-employed independent business people. We file our own taxes. We many of us have LLCs. We have insurance in that. And so it's the Business Enterprise Program, Randall Shepard Program, have been the most successful employment opportunity for blind in the history of the United States. There's over 70% blind Americans, and that's a shame. And so this program, near and dear to our heart. So, but that's how it works. We're governed by the Rehabilitative Services Administration. So it's really complicated and complex, but that's basically how it works. And if there's any other questions, I'm sure my buddy Art can answer them for you. But I would like to share a little bit about the House bill in front of you and how it came, and just highlight briefly some of the key elements that we believe are so much in need here in Oregon. Successful state programs such as Tennessee employ nearly 100 blind vendors in their businesses. In Oregon, unfortunately, right now we only have 14. We've only had one new blind vendor entered our program in the last 10 years, again, is a shame. So we're looking at this bill as a job creation bill, right? We want it to align with the federal act, but we want it to bring remunerative employment opportunities in for blind Oregon residents and grow it. So a few of the things through the proposed legislation, and please do note that there are amendments currently in legislative council, and they're expected to be out no sooner than Wednesday. So we're hoping to be able to balance all this with the blessing of the chair and the committee, and find a way to, you know, potentially get a work session scheduled out. Hopefully that'll be taken into consideration. But the priority of the act. So in Oregon, that definitely needs to align with the federal act. Just for the record, again, there's a recent federal court ruling by Judge Magistrate Yu in Oregon, who identified the need for the Oregon Commission for the Blind to provide the intent of the act, and that's putting blind people to work, making sure that they reach the remunerative employment opportunities, the enlarger economic opportunities, and they make themselves self-sufficiency. So we're trying to align the state act with the federal act and in compliance with also the ruling. There's an opportunity for the Legislative Assembly every year to see how this commission is serving the blind population. Are they fiscally responsible? Are they spending the money properly? Are they putting blind to work? And not necessarily only in the business enterprise program, but generally, how is that agency doing? So we incorporated that into the legislation. You guys get to see how this state agency is doing, and not just when they're coming to the Legislative Assembly asking for money, right? Okay. So the other thing is, near and dear to Chair Kenny Geyer's heart, is the healthy best practices, okay? We've been here a few years ago, and in that time, what I can share with you is that I, along with other blind vendors and our teaming partners, have taken the lead. We have worked with Washington County. We've worked with Multnomah County. We've worked with Clackamas County, and we have developed pilot projects. We have developed an implementation plan of best vending practices, and that has been so successful because we have worked with the wellness committees. We've done tastings, and it hasn't been it's been something sensible, something that people want to buy, something that makes sense for us as entrepreneurs, and something that makes sense and meets the benchmarks for the population. We base our guidelines on the National Automated Merchandising Association, largest association in the United States, and that is the FitPick. Through Canteen Compass Group, we have Choice Plus, but they're all dialed in to provide those best practices guidelines. We also are encouraging active participation, which we identify as inclusion of the blind vendors. It is mandated through the Federal Act and State Act that we should and shall actively participate on any major administrative and policy decision that impacts us. In the states that really make it happen and work together well, that happens, unfortunately, in Oregon. That hasn't happened, so we're trying to find a way to help guide that. We believe that with our years of experience, we can help the agency work together, and we can find a win-win for everybody. There are some other things within the act itself, or within the proposed legislation, but if we can take the lead and make Oregon a shining example and put blind to work, you know, the agency wants to generate more revenues. Let's build more businesses. We pay 11% right now of our net proceeds every month that goes in to the Commission for the Blind. It's matched at a 4-to-1 through Rehabilitative Services Administration to help offset the operational costs or what you would have. So, you know, if the agency wants more money, let's create more jobs. Let's make more entrepreneurs. Let's bring that money in, and let's find it that way. So with that being said, thank you very much for your time.
Okay. Thank you, Randy.
It's going to be kind of hard to follow that. But, my name is Art Stevenson. I've been a blind license manager in the vending program here in Oregon for 31 years. I'm one of the fortunate ones. Randy alluded to the fact that the unemployment rate across this great country of ours is 70%. And when you have a 70% unemployment rate, you discussed a lot about affordable housing in here tonight and several bills. Well, it's kind of hard to afford anything when you're unemployed. I do want to say that, as Randy alluded to, there are a lot of successful programs across the country where they have over 100 blind license managers in the vending program. And as Randy said, we're down to 15. When I first got into the program 30 years ago, we had 34. We're going backwards, not forwards. The Federal Randolph-Shepard Act allows us a priority on federal properties. We want to strengthen this law to make sure that we have a priority on state and other properties, municipal. But also, the Act says other properties, and that means with the help from the Commission for the Blind, we could actually, and I know other states do that, start up businesses, out there in the private sector. And that is going to help, by expanding this program, that's going to help employ blind Oregonians and help the unemployment rate. And so I encourage you to support this bill. We do have some amendments coming. There's, some things we definitely need to work out. But the one thing we need to do is we need to start moving forward and investing in blind Oregonians to be independent and have jobs so that they don't have to depend on the state of Oregon to support them, which is the current situation in this state. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Art.
Good evening, Chair Kinney-Geyer and committee. My name is James Edwards, President of the American Council of Blind of Oregon. I'm here to speak on behalf of the American Council of Blind of Oregon and ACB National in support of House Bill 3253. I am familiar with the Oregon Commission for the Blind and with the Business Enterprise Program, both as a participant. I served a term as commissioner in 2009 and 10, and as an observer stakeholder as president of ACBO for the last 8 years. Our purpose as a consumer organization of 150-plus members of blind Oregon citizens is to advocate for the rights and welfare of the blind. The Randolph-Shepard Act, under which the Business Enterprise Program operates, gives those who choose to take advantage of it an opportunity to create their own business, nourish and expand it, and ultimately, through hard work, reap the benefits. However, over the many years this program has been in place, it has not been without its issues. The statutes that govern it seem to impede the growth of the program, prompting Mr. House to closely examine the statutes and, through his many years of experience in the program, identify some key elements of the statutes that, if implemented, will help the administration of this program be more effective and efficient, creating an opportunity for quality employment for blind individuals in Oregon, helping them to successfully pursue the American dream. The Randolph-Shepard Act was created in 1936 solely for the purpose of enhancing employment opportunities for trained, licensed blind persons to operate facilities in federal and other properties and making them self-supportive and productive members of our society. The program is a great success in many states, generating a national average income of $56,000. We want Oregon's program to become an exemplary program, one we can all be proud of. We believe this proposed legislation will help us make that happen. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Got another one coming up? Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you so much. We have Marcy Furnish and Char McKenzie.
I think her name is just put down because she's one of the licensed blind managers.
Char?
She's fine.
Looks like she's coming.
Oh, good.
With a cute puppy dog walking backwards. It's a very talented dog there walking backwards.
And she doesn't have the dog.
She's backwards, too.
Aw. Aw. She's like ready to go out the door.
Food.
I'm done. That's late.
Good evening, Madam Chair and Vice Chair Representative Sanchez, and also Vice Chair Representative Olson. this is close to my heart because I work really closely with a lot of these amazing licensed blind managers through the Business Enterprise Program.
Your name?
My name is Marcy Furnish. Almost forgot. I'm the president of MGM Vending, LLC. And I'm just proposing my support for the legislation, House Bill 3253, and associated amendments that are being reviewed at this time. My company works alongside the Licensed Blind Managers of Business Enterprise Program, which is BEP, under the direction of the Oregon Commission for the Blind. I'm very familiar with the Federal Randolph Shepherd Act in its entirety and have a special working relationship with the BEP of Oregon and the licensed blind managers that I serve. I've served these organizations since 2003. I support their needs in hopes of them working towards an invigorating plan to move forward with the focus on the goal being to help the licensed blind managers become self-sufficient through owning their own independent businesses, as was intended by the Randolph Shepherd Act. I have unfortunately seen the Business Enterprise Program, with through the direction of the Commission for the Blind, advise me to reroute those 11% commissions that you just heard about to them, creating, I don't know where the money goes, to be quite honest, because when a blind manager moves to a different building, when a blind manager passes away, as a couple of years ago one did, Joe Bassett, and also if one is terminated, that leaves that building void, so ready for another licensed blind manager to come in. One of my buildings, the Edith Green Building, Wendell Wyatt Building in Portland, have been void of a licensed blind manager since 2013. They told me they didn't have anyone in line that was trained, that was qualified for to take that position. And I find it quite hard, you know, why that commission is even there when they say 4 years without a licensed blind manager in there. So I have rerouted my commissions to specifically the Commission for the Blind. I write the check to the Commission for the Blind, not the Business Enterprise Program even. I have no idea where that goes. And this has been going on, like I said, till 2013 when the Edith Green went to Wyatt, when Joe Bassett died. they call these unassigned buildings. And right now, I pay for 5 buildings under this unassigned category. And I do it on the form that they want me to do and so on and write the check. And they still say that they haven't found a qualified, unemployed, licensed blind manager to take over a building when that is their job, to promote entrepreneurship for and business opportunities for blind people. So for 4 years, monies have gone to the Commission for the Blind for me for commissions that should have been given to blind managers. I have no idea where that money goes. The commission has lost its focus. My hope is that the commission will get back to the Randolph Shepherd Act, which started in 1936 and has moved forward and has had two, I think 74 was the last time it was really even dissected and looked at, and to really understand what opportunities it entitles these people. That was the whole reason for the Randolph Shepherd Act. My hope is that the commission will get back to the Randolph Shepherd Act and stop this practice, and that they will do their job and encourage blind people to enlist in the program. The loss of the whole mission statement goes into question if this continues. Please help bring the Oregon Commission for the Blind and the Business Enterprise Program in compliance with the Randolph Shepherd Act. Bring back the stability and function of this act to the blind community. They deserve to be treated fairly. And that's what I have to say. Do you have anything?
Yeah. My name is Charlotta Hawkins, and I've been in the Business Enterprise Program for 18 years. I'm now manager of the food service at DMV headquarters on Lina Avenue. I am very shortly embarking on a new project, which is we receive money to purchase machines in the last legislature, and my machines have been purchased, and I will, by the end of the month, be servicing 30 of the vending machines in different buildings that are attached they were originally attached to help cafeterias that were lower earning income to increase their income. And I'm looking forward to this opportunity. I believe this is a work program. I believe there are many opportunities for other blind people that want to work. And there are some cafeterias, even in Salem, that one manager is operating more than one because we don't have other trained individuals that are looking at this. And I'm hoping that that's all going to change and in the future. And I thank you for the opportunity to do this, and for you guys, I appreciate that you're going to look at this new bill, and hopefully it will strengthen our program in the state. And so I appreciate everything, and we're looking forward to some new opportunities for other blind individuals also. So thank you.
Thank you. Now you can go out and enjoy your frisbees.
No. We have a few more bills. Oh, yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, please don't wait. Don't leave yet.
I just had
a question for you. Well, related to the program.
Tushar. Did you want the question?
Tushar? No, for you.
Oh,
well,
okay.
Maybe you can help.
Sure.
Yeah. Is it the Commission for the Blind that organizes and runs this program?
Mm-hmm.
And I am totally sorry for not being more aware.
Oh, that's
right. But how do folks that are blind or become blind, how are they introduced and how do they get to access to the services for the Commission of the Blind? And then, you know, what kind of...
Recruitment?
Mm-hmm. And who recruits them then?
Do you know that?
I believe that vocational counselors are talking to them about our program. And actually, I do happen to know that we have a manager she's not a manager, she was a trainee, and she's going to be receiving her license next week. That's what she told me. And I actually helped train her at DMV. And so I do believe that there are people, you know, that are going to be coming into the program, and they're developing a training program that may be more streamlined so we can get more managers.
Chair Geyer, if I may, I can sum that up real quick for the representative.
Sure, announce your name.
So
again,
Randy Hout, for the record. It is the responsibility of the Oregon Commission for the Blind to select, train, license, and install licensed blind vendors in these locations. And one of the things in the legislation is the amendments, as you look through it, it encourages that to occur. It requires it to occur. There's been a lapse in that, obviously. Don't necessarily know why, but it is the responsibility of the agency to administer the program. So,
okay, well, thank you very much, sir, and thank you.
You're welcome.
Just follow up because, appreciate it.
No, that's great. But, Eric, I think it would be great if you could come up. I know you didn't sign up, but Eric works for the Commission of the Blind.
Okay.
And I think it would be helpful, again, because we've got so many new members of the committee, and I know you've been in front of our committee before, but we have 6 out of the 9 of us. I'm not sure how many. Let me see. 3 or 4, depending on how to count you, are new up here.
Sure.
So just a little bit about the Commission on the Blind and how the Blind Entrepreneurial Program fits into...
Chair Kenny
Blind Enterprise Program. Sorry,
members of the committee. I can't read your name, so I'll that seems to be working tonight. So I'll use that. Good morning. I think we're on track for a good morning. great question, Representative. The Oregon Commission for the Blind. Many people, if you're not blind, I know people have been talking about.
Oh, Nate, can you put your name for the record, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name's Eric Morris. I'm the director of the Business Enterprise Program at the Commission for the Blind. Mm-hmm. The Commission for the Blind, if you haven't been a blind Oregonian or know a blind Oregonian, isn't something that's on your radar usually. I'm a 48-year Oregonian, and I've been blind for 8 years, so almost 9. So I didn't know anything about the Commission for the Blind until about 4 years ago when I joined the commission.
our main purpose, the overall agency, the bulk of the agency, is designed to help Oregonians who lose vision or have vision loss or leading to vision loss to get a regular job in the community and, you know, just be a regular member of the community. Now, my program is a small, small program within the agency that manages the Randolph-Shepard program, which is the federal act. And then the state statutes we're talking about today are the version that covers the state of Oregon for the state side of it. So most people, when they lose their vision, come to the commission and say, I can't see, you know, think about how you got up this morning. If you can't see anymore, how do you get dressed? How do you cook your food? How do you get around? All those things, how do you navigate? All those things are things that we take care of at the commission to get you orientated and back on your feet. And that's predominantly what the agency does. And then my program is a small program. I have five staff members, including myself, and we have 14 licensed blind managers in it right now. And Char kind of let the cat out of the bag a little bit. We are going to be licensing a new person next week, so we're adding another person back in. It's not a big secret, but I didn't expect to talk about it in front of a House committee tonight. Mm-hmm. But, so that's what the commission does. My boss would do a much better job explaining it in a much longer version, but that's what we do.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. Well, thank you, sir. I'm Representative Meek. Oh, but what I'm looking for is what is the capacity right now to implement the Randolph-Shepard program, and how many opportunities are available for some folks, and then how are we trying to connect the, you know, both the folks that may be willing or able to train for that, and get that up to full 100% capacity or more?
Well, and I think that's a great question. Thank you, sir. One of the things that I looked at when I came into the program, because our program is small, and so is Washington and Idaho's program. There's relatively close numbers. And when you compare us to, like, Texas as a percentage of the population, Texas has 110-some-odd operators, plus tons of federal locations, which Oregon, you know, we're a small state and a small population, but percentage-wise, we're almost exact, 3.7 versus 3.8% of the population versus licensed blind managers. So, because that's one thing I wanted to determine too, because ultimately we want our operators to be earning a wage that is livable. And if I remember correctly, on our federal report, it's $52,000 or $53,000 average for Oregon, which is a that's pretty good. So the other side of that coin is, as you heard earlier, there was many more people in the program years ago. But if you think about what blind people can do, and we heard it earlier this week in Senate testimony, well, people who are blind, I can't go drive a truck, but there's not much else that I can't do. So as people are coming into our agency looking for things to do in life, to be a representative or to be a school board member or things like that, or anything else you can think of that doesn't involve, like, driving or flying a plane, maybe, then people can, there's ways to get around that. There's always an adaptive tool to use, or, you know, a mechanism to make that happen. So culturally, things have changed. And I would not profess to be a VR expert, but I can just tell you how things are. As a blind person myself, I can do it all except for drive. I haven't figured out hunting yet either, but which is probably a good thing. But somebody told me we could go do it, and they could take care of the business. I'm like, well, that's no fun. So things are changing. So in food service, which is the predominant amount of our business, is food service, cafeterias, snack bars, vending. There's a small segment of the regular society, non-blind society, that does that. So if you scale that down to the blind community, as we've talked about, we're a smaller group. There's even a smaller group that's interested in doing that. So we actively recruit. I have a training specialist who spends dedicated time with every single VR counselor we have at the agency every single month trying to recruit people into the program to get it fired back up and get people into the program.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So I wanted to say a couple of things about my perspective on this. You may have noted that there's been a little conflict between some of the blind vendors and the commission. I think that came out today, and if you've been involved in this issue in the past few years, you might know that that's the case. And I think some of the legislation as well as the amendments that we're considering are trying to get at several things. One is the blind vendors would really like more transparency and accountability on the part of the commission and feel like they're really working with the commission to help develop the training and recruitment and business development and finding more locations and things like that. So that's one thing, and I hope nod your head if you think I've gotten that quite, if I've gotten that right. So part of the legislation is trying to get at the Commission on the Blind reporting back, having some transparency, reporting back about the funds and things like that. And then I would say there's been some frustration on the part of the commission, as well as others, maybe executive branch, not just the current one, but in the past I've heard this, that there's a sense that the Randolph-Shepard Act gives the first right of refusal to operate vending machines on state and federal, and I think in municipal or wherever we can find public sector places. And then much of the work there, that once they get this contract, then many of them contract out with Canteen, I know is one, and I can't remember the one that you mentioned. What's the name of yours?
MGM.
There has been a concern that in a no-bid contract situation that, there's a fear that some of the blind vendors can contract out and then receive a check but not necessarily be actively managing. That's the fear. I don't know if it's true, but that is a fear. Or perhaps by contracting out, not doing as much employment opportunities for other blind people or other people with disabilities as possible. And so the question is this an employment program or entitlement program? I'm going to put this very starkly here just to lay out some of the concerns that I've heard on all sides. And so some of the things that we're looking at now, so the original legislation was brought to me by, and this is a committee bill, brought to me by the blind vendors wanting to have more accountability and engagement with the Commission on the Blind and the Blind Enterprise Program. And some of the things that that I've tried to bring forward in conversation, and we've had several conversations, I don't think we're quite close, and we're going to have an April 18th deadline coming up, and we have to figure out, do we pass it to the other side? Do we pass it to rules? Because I think we're not quite there with the amendments yet to find the right balance. But another issue and conflict has been when we have two different legal interpretations. One is from the Attorney General saying that we're not allowed, actually, the blind vendors are not allowed to just contract out and not meaningfully engage people. And then we have another attorney opinion from that the blind vendors got that said, actually, we are. So there's some conflict there. And I think when people are operating in a gray area, it's really hard to fully develop the program. And I'd like to see that resolved. So part of the opportunity for this legislation is to resolve that once and for all and to make it clear that something is allowable. So what is that something? So the third piece of this is we put several options on the table and discussed different ideas about so what the commission has done in the last year is said, we interpret this with the Attorney General opinion. We interpret that you may not just contract out. You have to really give opportunities for people to, you have to really manage the program and hire lots of people. So they started going in that direction and asking people to all make a change from the way they're currently operating with other contracting vending companies, and that's caused a lot of friction for people who've been operating their program for a long time and who feel that they're doing it in a very meaningfully engaged way. So some of the one of the options that seemed most popular, and we just had the amendment at 454 put online. I think it's the dash two, and I haven't had a chance to read it. But what that was trying to get at was providing choice, clarifying in the statutes that they are allowed to contract out. That was seemed that's very important to some people who are operating that way, but that the what's called set aside or the commission that they give back to the Commission on the Blind, they would have to do a higher amount if back to the Commission on the Blind if they were going to operate where they were doing the contract vending, but that they would do a less set aside or they would give less commission than they currently do if they are engaging more people in employment, and particularly if they're engaging blind people and people with disabilities, and furthermore, they could get more points if they do any healthy vending. So that's the idea. I have no idea how it came out. There's certain numbers there that are just placeholder numbers, so we have a lot of conversations to have. But those are some of the accountability and reporting and having the commission work in a more transparent and accountable way and really engaging the blind vendors in the business enterprise program is one set. The clarification of the statute in terms of whether and under what conditions these contract vending can be used. And then thirdly, some kind of incentive, using the set-aside as incentivizing or certain behavior or disincentivizing, really incentivizing them to do as to make this much as an employment program and active management as possible. So that's kind of how I see it in three different segments. But I think it deserves a lot more conversation, obviously, than by April 18th. And so we'll have discussions about how to keep the ideas alive and try to really meet all needs. And I think that if we can come to agreement on a program that people all feel good about, I think there's going to be a lot more enthusiasm about really building it up and more working together, which has to happen for this program to really build up. So that's my take on where we are. Okay, so I think that's it, unless anyone else wants a final word on that. All right, so we're going to close the House Bill 32, public hearing on House Bill 3253, and open a public hearing on House Bill 3372. Yay. Representative Sanchez and Cassie, can you please read the summary?
House Bill 3372 requires coordinated care organizations to provide initial health screening for each foster child under 19 years of age no later than 60 days after the child enrolls in a CCO or the child enters the foster care system, whichever date is earlier. The bill requires CCOs to locate the child and arrange initial health screening if the child has not received the screening within 60 days, and requires CCOs to report to Oregon Health Authority on noncompliance, and requires OHA to analyze the report and reduce barriers to compliance. The bill directs OHA to report on rates of compliance by September 15, 2018.
Okay.
All right. Good evening, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Olson, Tana Sanchez, Representative for House District 43, North and Northeast Portland. House Bill 3372 was, as you're all aware, one of my major issues in this, in coming to the legislature, is about kiddos in foster care. One of the things that I struggled with as a service provider was the fact that children were not getting their needs met in a lot of different ways. I did learn that when children enter foster care, they are supposed to be put into a CCO or in some way get their health care needs met. But, of course, knowing many, many families who are foster families and who are, you know, their kiddos were put into those CCOs, but they weren't always getting their needs met in terms of health evaluation assessments, mental health, and dentistry. In particular, a family that I know that a young woman took on a sibling set of three, and these children had been hoteled for a while before she got them. Prior to that, they had been in the system for a year and a half, and none of them had received any dental care whatsoever. And the youngest one, who was 5 years old, apparently had never seen the dentist. And when she went into the dentist, they have to put her out every time she goes to the dentist because pretty much every one of her teeth is going to have to be capped. This is not acceptable, in my opinion. So what I understand, again, from the CCOs is that they do have, an incentive to get this done within 60 days. Apparently, the metrics are not being met. So this is my answer to it. There is going to be an amendment to remove the piece of when the child enters the foster care system so that the 60 days will begin at the day that they're actually enrolled in the CCOs. And then the CCOs have that responsibility to follow up and make sure that these kiddos get seen for medical, dental, and mental health assessments.
Okay, great. And we have two people, Bill Busca. Oh, do you want to have a question for Representative Sanchez?
Yep. Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. I've had a lot of experience with this as well. And one of my questions on just the details of how this would work out is, our experience is we have multiple CCOs in my area, and we've used both of them. Our experience so far has been that the CCOs and the coverage, once they're enrolled, you know, we've had no problem getting them in and so forth. But oftentimes, so the current scenario is every time a child changes placement, they're supposed to have a, you know, a checkup within 30 days. It doesn't matter if they had one last month with a different provider. Every time they change, you're supposed to have one. And there are things that will cause them, so, and each provider can choose, or each foster parent can choose which CCO. I mean, we've done that. We've changed everybody so they're all at the same spot, that sort of thing. And so one of my concerns with the way this is drafted, because I love the concept, is how the onus on the CCO to now track that child.
If they're changing to a different CCO, then it is the other one. It is whoever they go to. I mean, we can look at changing that as well, but my concern overall is making sure that somebody sees them. Okay. Because what often doesn't happen is that their medical information doesn't follow them, as you're very well aware. They could be dropped off at a foster home where somebody doesn't know if they have an allergy, where somebody doesn't know whether or not they have all of their shots. I've had kiddos that I've gotten a notice, hey, you know, your kiddo's going to be, you know, excluded from school because they haven't had their shots. Well, nobody told me anything about this kiddo not having shots. Mm-hmm. So, you know, those types of things that we want to really get to. We can get to minutia, but I just want to make sure that it happens and that somebody's paying attention to it, and that kiddos don't have to go that long without going to the dentist and getting those needs taken care of.
One more thing, and I did read the bill, but I don't recall if it addresses
this. It's short.
Yeah, it was easy to read, so easy to forget, too. As far as, because it says that I'm trying to remember the terminology it used, that the CCO would basically take active measures to kind of track them down and go. Is there some, because, and if it's, this is part of their metrics, is there anything that, like, I mean, some parents just don't. And that falls on the caseworker enforcing that with the foster parent. Mm-hmm. But I would want to make sure that we're not, if in those scenarios, that we're not somehow punishing the CCO when someone else is making that decision.
So you're speaking of the coordinated care organization shall act affirmatively to locate the child and make arrangements for an initial health screening. And you're right. There are, you know, situations where either the caseworker's not initiating or the foster parent is not following up. There's no punitive anything necessarily. We just want to see these numbers go up. We want to see kiddos get more access to health care.
Fair enough. Thanks.
Okay, great. We've got Bill Buska and John Ames.
Good evening, Chair Kenny-Geyer, Vice Chairs Olson and Sanchez, members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity for testify on 3372, which focuses on the initial health assessment for children in foster care. My name is Bill Buska. I'm the Director of Community Solutions and Government Affairs for Intercommunity Health Network Coordinated Care Organization. We are one of the 16 CCOs that serve Lynn, that includes the beautiful city of Albany and Benton and Lincoln counties. And we serve about 51,000 individuals in those three counties. We're strongly committed to providing necessary services and supports for our members, and value the partnerships that we've developed between our CCO, DHS, child welfare, foster parents, and the providers in our community to facilitate the health services for kids in the foster care system. As was just discussed, all CCOs have an incentive metric that for us to provide physical health, mental health, and oral health assessments within 60 days of the state notifying us that a CCO member has been placed in the custody of DHS. Since 2014, oral health was added to that metric, and since that time in 2014, with two measurement years, we've approximately doubled the amount of the percentage of the kids who met that metric, so who received all three of those assessments within within 60 days. So as a statewide basis, approximately 68% of the kids as of June of 2015, about 68% of the kids had received those three assessments within 60 days. We're pretty confident that when our next performance report comes out this summer, that it'll significantly increase from there. The benchmark, the ultimate goal, is to have 90%, and we're working with a lot of systems, and this is a really complicated system that includes the enrollment issues that for the CCO for a child to get enrolled through OHA, coordinating with the foster parent, coordinating with DHS, and then prioritizing all those services with our provider networks. So there's a lot of different challenges that come into place even when everything works out really well, and we're really dependent on DHS and the foster parents really to help facilitate that and to make sure the kids are getting to those things. And y'all know within 60 days of a child coming into foster care, there is a lot of casework being done and lots of things happening, and frequently the child moves even within the same town multiple times within those 60 days. So it takes a lot of coordination and a lot of work. But we're very committed to it. It's an extremely important population, and we want to do the best job that we can. As Representative Sanchez mentioned, there is some tweaks that we'll be working on with her about, really, we can only do things for CCO members, and once we know about them having 60 days to do it is part of the standard that we want to accomplish. So we thank you for the opportunity to testify, and happy to work further on this bill and get it to a good place. Thank you.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jonathan Eames, and I'm here on behalf of HealthShare. My testimony is under 45 minutes, so no worries. I know it's late. First of all, thank you, Representative Sanchez, for bringing this bill forward. I think from HealthShare's perspective, the focus on foster youth and children in DHS custody is critical. About 2.5 years ago, HealthShare launched an initiative to really focus on this population, because the adverse health outcomes that were coming from foster youth were showing up in various places around the health system. So we've really focused on the foster youth and trying to do everything we can, including, I have a list here of, hiring full-time foster care systems manager. We did a year-long collaborative with 7 local health clinics and clinic systems to explore and implement foster care medical home models in our delivery system, launched a care coordination platform to allow coordination between a number of plans and child welfare to improve access. We grant-funded a medical liaison position within local child welfare. We provided trainings and partnered with local child abuse medical centers to develop specialized medical exams for children entering the care. So this is really important to us and your bill. And also, I want to say that House Bill 2580, which was introduced, I think you know about this, by Representative Rayfield, and then also Representative Fahey is involved in that one as well, is dealing with that specific issue where kids are transitioning from one CCO to another, and we've helped on that one as well, and that one should be heard and hopefully moved in the next week. It should be before the 18th. So really appreciate the opportunity to come and testify. We agree with Mr. Buska, the particular issues that Representative Stark raised, and then also that you said there will be an amendment to fix are kind of our issues around it, but we just wanted to say thank you for bringing it forward, and we look forward to working on the bill with you.
Thank you. Okay. Yes, Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair again, Kenny Geyer, and thank you, members of the committee, for indulging me this late at night. So not entirely directly to the bill, but I've never had an opportunity to bring this up, and you guys might be able to answer this. So 4 or 5 times in the last 3 to 4 years between my 3 now legally adopted children, we've had, without notice and without our request and without a change in placement, we've had the children, we receive a letter or something, and the children have been switched from one care, from one CCO or to open card or to the other CCO without our notice. Now, each time, because I haven't always been as resourced as I am now as far as network, but each time I was able to call somebody and they were able to get it fixed pretty quick, it did actually prevent a doctor from seeing one of my daughters at one point with an ear infection because we had not been notified it had changed.
Have you guys seen that happening throughout the state, and do you have any idea why that would happen?
Nobody wants.
You're not even leaning forward.
No, I'm half the answer. So, go ahead.
He's getting farther and farther back. Yeah.
Madam Chair, Representative Stark, it's a good question. One of the things that we've been really focused on in working with the Oregon Health Authority, and one of the things that House Bill 2580 does is actually auto-enrolls children into foster care, into CCOs, excuse me, auto-enrolls kids in foster care into CCOs. And the reason we want to do that at the nearest applicable time is so that they can start that consistency of care. The last thing you want to do is in with a child who's already in crisis or in a difficult situation is really throw their care into tumult. So we really have been working to, and House Bill 2580 requires that they auto-enroll into CCOs. Maybe Mr. Buska can talk about why they're going moving back into fee-for-service and back or even going to another CCO. That doesn't make sense to me, but do you have an answer?
Yes, Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Stark. First, what I would say is that the CCOs don't have anything to do with enrollment. That is totally removed from us, and there is a wall put up between that so that we can't affect enrollment and really have any impact on that. So that process all happens within the Oregon Health Authority. There are multiple reasons why when there could be shifts, when there could be an age change or there could be a shift to a different rate category, that it would cause something to happen in the enrollment system. But as a coordinated care organization, we experience the same thing with our enrollment and that discontinuity of care. So it is something we're actively working on with the Oregon Health Authority to help stabilize that enrollment. And the bill that Mr. Ames talked about really will help with that. But it's really a Oregon Health Authority operated part of the system.
So it might be a new bill I need to get on.
Yes, exactly.
One more thing.
You might want to add.
Yeah. One more thing, Representative Kennedy Guy, Representative Stark. One of the things that House Bill 2580 kind of proposes is to kind of have a healthcare passport so that that child has something that is transferable among CCOs. Now, CCOs are required to do this transition of care regardless, but as Representative Rayfield identified and others have, in some limited cases, there is some problems with that transition. So the goal, if you know we find the funds to be able to do it, is to really track those children very closely so that wherever they're going, that they don't have that break in care. If they're seeing a provider, you know, a behavioral health provider, mental health or addiction provider in one area and that's really working for them, you don't want to break that care if they're moving down from Portland to Salem or Portland, Eugene, something so that they have time to transition and find a better provider. That's the whole goal, is to try to just make it as smooth as possible in an otherwise difficult situation.
Okay. Sounds good. All right.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3372. And we've got two more to go, and these should be fast. I'm going to open the work session on House Bill 2881. I see you out there. You probably don't need to make any statement. You're there if we have a question. Cassie, could you please read the summary?
House Bill 2881 appropriates $700,000 from the general fund to Department of Human Services for the Oregon Hunger Response Fund. The bill declares an emergency effective on passage. There's a sub-referral to Joint Ways and Means. The fiscal is $700,000 from the general fund, and there's no revenue impact.
And we're in a work session, right?
Here we are.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2881 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Olson moves House Bill 2881 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion? We heard this last week. Had a big hunger presentation. We've been doing this for years, and hunger's going up, and I think it's a very important issue. Okay. Seeing no further discussion, Ashley, please call the roll.
Representative Gorsuch?
Excused.
Representative Meek?
Aye.
Representative
Nierman?
Aye.
Representative
Noble?
Excused.
Representative
Peluso?
Excused.
Representative Stark?
Yep.
Vice Chair Olson?
Yep.
Vice Chair Sanchez?
Aye.
It's late. Yep. Okay. Motion passes. Close the work session on 2881. Thank you for your patience back there. Got one more here.
going to open a work session on House Bill 2547. This is Representative Hack's gatekeeper program. We heard this a long time ago. Would you like to remind us, Cassie?
Yeah, House Bill 2547 appropriates money from the general fund to Department of Human Services for operation of Northwest Senior and Disability Services Gatekeeper Program. The bill declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2017. We heard this on February 16th. We do have a dash one, which increases the appropriation amount to $176,000. There's a sub-referral to Joint Ways and Means, and the fiscal is $176,000 for the 17-19 biennium, and the revenue has no impact.
So, Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated March 17, 2017.
Vice Chair Olson moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated March 17, 2017. Any discussion? I just want to remind you, Gatekeeper Program was one that we used to fund, and then it was, yeah. I think it just recently got axed or is axed in this budget, but it helps notify, is awareness building for people that deliver mail or in restaurants or in grocery stores who might be, or and even neighbors who are near vulnerable seniors, so that they can alert them if it looks like they need some help. I see some nodding in the back, so I hope I'm describing this correctly. We heard it on the same day that we heard about the Oregon Project Independence. We don't have a bill, but I know there's a financial request for that. But these are really, really important programs for keeping vulnerable seniors in their homes, living independently as long as possible. It's a very, very small amount, really just to keep the program going so that we don't totally close it, because then it's harder to start it back up, but it's really stripped down to kind of the bare minimum here. Okay. Any other discussion? Okay, seeing none, can you please call the roll?
That's on the amendment.
That was the amendment.
Sorry. Okay, is there any objection to the amendment? All right, seeing none, amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2547 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation, and the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Olson moves House Bill 2547 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion? Okay. Seeing none, clerk, please call the roll.
Representative
Borsig? Excused.
Representative Meek?
Aye.
Representative Nearman?
Aye.
Excused.
Representative
Peluso? Excused.
Representative
Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sanchez?
Aye.
Chair Kinnegar?
Yep. Okay. House Bill 2547 passes to Ways and Means. And I close the work session on House Bill 2547, and we are adjourned.
Wait.
No? Oh. Close the work session on House Bill 2547, and we are adjourned.
Wait.